The Solid Monster sounds off.
Hulk Hogan has definitely been that rocket fuel that TNA needed.
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
I'm fat. You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
That's my best reenactment of the fan reaction to the return of Evolution on Raw this past Monday night. You could hear a pin drop in that arena. It was actually kind of sad that they would get that kind of response or lack of response. But we'll get into the return of Evolution and a whole lot more. We are here for episode 324 of the Solid Monster Sounds Off for Easter Sunday, April 20th, 2014. I am the Solid Monster. Happy Easter to everybody who celebrates, who may be listening to the podcast today, which you can download on thesolidmonster.com, Stitcher Radio, or iTunes. And I want to give a big thanks to one of our listeners, Bryant Guzman, who wrote to the folks at player.fm and got the Sound Off added there as a featured podcast. So you can now stream the show from there as well. They also have a free Android app, as we do. And you can listen to us through there or just use the official Sound Off Android app, which is also free. Lots of ways to get the show. This is just one more. So my thanks to Bryant for the assist there. If there's any other services that you feel we should be added to or should apply for consideration, by all means, let me know. And if I think it's worthwhile, we'll try to make that happen. My goal is to make the show as accessible to as many people as possible. So my thanks to Bryant for that. Also, thank you to the people who have signed up for an Audible trial through our custom URL, audibletrial.com/solidmonster. People signing up to use the service. You get one free audiobook when you do so, which you get to keep whether you keep the trial going beyond 30 days or if you cancel so you don't get billed. Either way, you get to keep that free audiobook. People seem pretty happy with it. And again, it's just another way to support the podcast. So audibletrial.com/solidmonster, free for 30 days. You can try it out and get a free audiobook that's still going on, at least for a little while longer. And also some PayPal shout-outs. Had a lot of people donate this week. Antoine Moore, friend of the show, who actually has a two-part video interview up on YouTube with the Mouth of the South, Jimmy Hart, that he filmed over by Hogan's Beach Shop down in Florida. So I wanted to give Antoine a little plug there for that. It's up on YouTube if you want to check that out. Also, PayPal shout-outs for Chuck Lunatic Lentz. Chuck's the man. I love Chuck. Adam Maniac Misaglia, Ed the Strangler Crumlish, Brian Money Shot Martin. You like that one, huh? James Tapout Tingstrom, Deathblow David Floyd, Nash the Gravedigger Degolato, Daredevil Donde Page, and Luke I Don't Need Rehab Roland. Luke's his own man. He don't need no stinking rehab. So if you want a wrestling nickname, it's just a fun little thing that we do here. You can make a $10 PayPal donation or more to the Sound Off, but you can donate whatever you want to, whether you get a nickname or not. Again, it's my way of showing a little bit of appreciation to the people who go the extra mile to donate to the show, and you can do so on thesolidmonster.com. That's where you will find the PayPal donation box. So thank you to everybody who did so this week. Quick note here, I will have an update on my status with the Layfield Report at the end of the podcast. I'll save it for the end of the show. It's actually a very weird story. It's an unfortunate one. We'll get into that a little bit later on. So for those of you maybe who, end early, you don't stick around for the very end of the show, the outro and all that kind of stuff, you may want to stick around for that. That'll be coming up a little bit later on. But what I want to start out with here, before we get into Raw and all that other stuff, is the WWE Network. There was a lot of good stuff on the WWE Network this week, but none better than the Ultimate Legend, which is the Ultimate Warrior 60-minute-long documentary that WWE put together, aired originally on Thursday night, right before NXT. It's up on demand right now. You can check it out anytime you want to if you have a network subscription. I cannot say enough good things about this documentary. It was, you know, I said this on Twitter, and I'll say it again here. The more, and I went back and watched it a second time. if it isn't the best thing that WWE, the best 60-minute long, be it a documentary or even just their regular programming, whatever it may be, the best 60 minutes I've ever seen produced by WWE. And if it isn't the best, it's top three of anything they've ever produced before. And that's pretty high praise. And I don't say that lightly. You know, I didn't go into it expecting it to be as good as it was. But I, when it was over and I came out of it, I just couldn't believe that they had been able to turn around something so awesome so quickly. And it's easily the best thing that the network has ever produced. I know they did the Daniel Bryan Journey to WrestleMania documentary. I like that one to a point. You know, with the Daniel Bryan thing, which was really just following him around leading up to WrestleMania, they interviewed him, Brie Bella, Cesaro, Seth Rollins, a whole bunch of people. They had some Ring of Honor footage, which was really cool. But about halfway through the Daniel Bryan documentary, it got too steeped in kayfabe. It was like, okay, you know, we have John Cena on his tour bus talking about how, you know, Daniel Bryan is facing the toughest challenge of his life. You know, he's in there with the game, Triple H, and it's like, all right, you know, you got to figure out what you want to be. Do you want this to be a straightforward, behind-the-scenes look at this guy's career and what he's getting ready for, or do you want this to be an in-character documentary? So there was a little bit of an identity crisis there, and I just really, it was hard to stomach some of that stuff. So the Daniel Bryan special was good. It's worth watching, but it can't touch the Warrior documentary. I mean, it's not even close. This is the best thing they've ever produced on that network, and it takes you on an emotional roller coaster. I mean, whether you like the Warrior or not is irrelevant. It doesn't matter. You know, if you thought the guy was a bad wrestler and a bad person, or if you were a big Warrior mark from your childhood to adulthood, it really doesn't matter. The quality of this is such that if you don't have a network subscription and you live in this country and you can pay the $9.99 and subscribe, I would tell you to do it just for this. I don't know if that free trial is still going on. They had a one-week free trial. If it is, it's a no-brainer. Sign up for the network, take advantage of the free trial, and if you don't do anything else, watch this documentary. You know, and it's so good, it wouldn't shock me at some point if they put this on television. Because, you know, the buzz around this has been that awesome that it's almost a shame the audience for it is so limited. I feel like, you know, it should have a much wider audience. So I hope they do get it on TV at some point. But I just want to run through some of the key stuff that was in the documentary for those who haven't seen it and what really made it such a strong piece. I mean, they go back to the early days of Warrior's career. They've got early Blade Runners footage in here of him and Sting that I didn't even know they had the rights to. And some of the footage of them working out and wearing the mascara and all that kind of stuff is stuff that I had never seen before. And they have some footage of matches from Mid-South and that sort of thing, which makes sense, I guess. They did spend some time in Mid-South, and now they have the Mid-South Library, so maybe that's where it all came from. But they show the Blade Runner stuff, along with fresh comments from Steve Borden, better known as Sting. And Sting made his debut on the WWE Network earlier in the week. He had taped something with his cell phone. Literally, it was like 10 seconds long. They had different wrestlers sharing anecdotes about the Warrior. And so Sting was somewhere. He recorded something on his phone, sent it into WWE, and it became a big story. Oh, well, Sting must be in with WWE, he must be signed, sealed, and delivered, and then there were reports that, well, he has a contract in hand, but it hasn't been signed and sent back to them yet, so nobody really knew what was going on. Well, this was fresh footage of Sting. It looked like he was in a hotel room, but this was WWE's camera crew filming comments from Sting. So I have no doubt in my mind that he's in. He's under contract, he's with WWE, and it's just a matter of time now until we see him pop up on television. So Sting's in. And it was cool that the timing, everything worked out perfectly because you never know. You know, things happen for a reason. Sting was with TNA for so many years, and only now has he finally come over to WWE. Well, here's this guy, Warrior, who he didn't really have much of a relationship with over the last, you know, 20 years. But early on, these guys broke into the business together, and it was very appropriate to be able to get Sting to comment on this. So there were a lot of fresh comments from him. You know, they covered the stuff when he came to WWE, building up to that WrestleMania 6 match with Hulk Hogan. Bobby Heenan pulled Warrior aside at an event one day and told him, hey, you know, your merchandise is outselling Hogan's, which was probably, you know, unheard of for that time. And that led to the WrestleMania 6 match. They went into detail about the professional rivalry between Hogan and Warrior. Warrior talked about it. Vince McMahon openly talked about how when you're a top guy, you're in a competition for your spot. And, you know, whether it's professional jealousy or just, you know, a rivalry between top guys. And we've heard stories from other people who have done interviews that have said, you know, they think that Vince McMahon, at least in the past, probably not today, but, you know, think back to Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels in the mid-90s, that Vince was as responsible as anybody for kind of stoking the professional fires between guys and wanting them to almost feud with each other because it kind of lit a fire under their ass. They would want to compete that much more for their spot. And here's Vince McMahon on a WWE documentary basically admitting it and basically talking about, you know, listen, this is what happens. And these guys are competing for a spot and there's going to be, you know, backstabbing and political shenanigans that go on. So that was kind of interesting hearing Vince talk about that. Warrior said Hogan had a motto. He used to say, you know, keep your enemies closer. I'm sure Hogan was intimidated by Warrior being on the rise. And here's this guy who is getting, you know, cheers like he is and selling more merchandise than he is. And now they want to put the title on him. And yeah, I don't want to say Hogan wanted to go out of his way to sabotage the Warrior because I don't think he did. But Hogan, even on this documentary, admits, he says, you know, I don't think the Warrior was ready at WrestleMania 6. And Warrior said he was still young. He was only 30, which just blows my mind when I go back and I watch that when Ultimate Warrior won the title from Hogan, he was only 30 years old. It's like, my God. Warrior and Sergeant Slaughter. This was something I even was not aware of. They had backstage footage from the Hall of Fame of Sarge coming into Warrior's dressing room to kind of say hello and reunite with the guy. And it was funny because he said, I have a gift for you. And the gift was a potato, which Warrior laughed uproariously about. And I just chalked it up to mean, you know, when they worked together, Warrior probably was still very green and maybe somewhat stiff, and he probably potatoed a lot of guys, including Sergeant Slaughter. And that just means, you know, he catches you with a real punch, gives you a black eye, that kind of stuff. I remember when Rob Van Dam came into WWE reading, you know, reports online that a lot of wrestlers, like top guys, were complaining that they were getting potatoed every night by RVD. You know, they were getting caught by a kick in the face and getting their mouth busted open or a mouse under their eye, that kind of stuff. Slaughter went into a little more detail about the significance of the potato. They did a Legends Roundtable on Friday night, which is also up on demand if you want to go back and watch it. Not really worth going out of your way to see like this. If you have you know, an hour to kill, I guess you can go watch it. It was Josh Matthews narrating a panel with Booker T, Sergeant Slaughter, and of all people, Ted DiBiase, who has made no bones about the fact that he hated the Ultimate Warrior, which is interesting that they would ask him to come on the show. But Sarge went into some more detail about the story in that they had worked a cage match back in 91 against one another. And that might have been the last match they ever worked. And I think they both knew it going in. It was probably on a house show somewhere. And Slaughter had a potato on him. Now, where he would keep this potato, I have no idea. But he claims he had the potato. There was a certain point in the match where Warrior nailed him, and Sarge took it out and kind of sent it flying in the air. And now the potato is in the ring. It's in the cage. It's rolling around. And Warrior picks it up and says, "What the hell is this? You know, who put a potato in the ring?" And he realizes, you know, we're in a steel cage here. It's not like the fans are going to be able to chuck it in. So he pretty much figured, okay, it was Slaughter. And anyway, backstage after the match, they had a nice laugh about it. And so here's the footage on this documentary, which when I watched it the first time, I didn't know the significance of it. But now I look back and I see Warrior here on the special laughing about it. And that was really, really cool. I mean, that's one of the really cool kind of personal moments that you get on this documentary. You know, a lot of times you watch WWE stuff and you don't know what's real and what's not, you know. And I'll use Hulk Hogan as an example because Hogan was all over this documentary. And there's a point later on where Triple H says, you know, he went to Hogan. He calls him Terry. Says he went to Terry and said he pleaded with him. He said, "Please, whatever you do, don't approach the Warrior until the Hall of Fame is over." The Warrior, he seemed really happy, really at peace. He was enjoying the event, enjoying the weekend. He didn't want to do anything that was going to set him off because he knew about the past with Hogan and Warrior. So he requested of Hogan, "Please leave him alone and don't approach him until after the Hall of Fame is over." and it was at the Superdome backstage of WrestleMania. Hogan said he was in a golf cart being driven around backstage, and he spotted the Warrior, had the golf cart stop, and he walked over and approached him, and they got the whole thing on camera. So right away you think to yourself, okay, how genuine is this? It's being filmed. But, you know, they did have cameras following these guys around all weekend, and with Hogan, you never know. Hogan is, I guess, in a different place in his life now. He's all about positivity and mending fences and that sort of stuff. So Hogan, you know, he's face-to-face here with the Warrior, and we're watching this. And Hogan just apologizes. He says, listen, I'm sorry for everything. It was all my fault. Please accept my apology. I'm hoping that we could even be friends. And to his credit, you know, Warrior is a straight shooter. He's standing there and, you know, he's saying to Hogan, listen, you did a lot of really nasty stuff in the past, and I want to be able to trust you. I want to be able to accept your apology. You can see he's kind of iffy about it, but then he finally does, and they shake hands. And it was a nice moment, you know, to see them, however genuine it was, to see them make up, you know, backstage. But I got to say this, you know, whatever Hogan did, whatever Hogan may have said, and you hear stories about Hogan, the master politician, and all that kind of stuff. I do feel like if I'm Hogan, I get why he's doing that, but does Hogan really need to be the one apologizing profusely to the Warrior? What did Hogan really ever do or say about the Warrior that was that bad compared to some of the shit that Warrior said about him in recent years? That whole YouTube video that's still up, it's like an hour long. And it was from like 2-3 years ago, and it's Warrior sitting in his basement talking about Hogan, all the drugs that he did, as though Warrior's a perfect angel. About Hogan offering his wife to Warrior for sex, which has never been corroborated. I have my doubts about that. I mean, that just sounds way out there to me. But I mean, Warrior said a lot of really nasty shit about Hogan, so I feel like it should be going both ways here. You know, it was only going one way in the special. Hogan was practically on his knees, you know, begging for forgiveness from the Warrior, but the Warrior should have probably apologized to him first for some of the shit that he said. But nonetheless, they made up, and that was cool. They covered the retirement match between Warrior and Savage from 1991. Then the SummerSlam stuff, which was litigated many years later. That was when they fired Warrior for allegedly holding up Vince for $500,000 before the show. Vince promised to give him the money, only so that he would go out and do the match. And then as soon as Warrior came back through the curtain, Vince pulled him aside in a meeting and fired him. And so that was interesting to hear them talk about that. We got some rare footage of Warrior at a post-WrestleMania 8 press conference that, unless they showed it on Superstars or Wrestling Challenge, I don't remember ever seeing this. It was Warrior. He was in his face paint. It may have been right after Mania ended. And he's talking like a normal person, answering questions, and says, in no uncertain terms, I came back to win the title. That's what he said. He said, I came back to become the champion, and in due time, it will happen. And of course, didn't exactly work out that way. But that's where things got really interesting in this documentary, because for the first time I can ever recall on anything produced by WWE, we had Vince McMahon talking openly about steroids and human growth hormone, which is awesome, because you can't do an Ultimate Warrior documentary without talking about steroids. You just can't. The two go together. Same thing with Hogan, but especially with Warrior, because Warrior had a physique far and above Hogan's. So I thought that was actually really refreshing to see. Now, did they tell the whole truth? Did they go into all the little specific details? Of course not. I didn't expect them to. But I didn't expect the word steroids to be mentioned on here either. And Vince is on there saying Warrior and Davey Boy Smith were found to be experimenting with HGH. And he stressed, you know, it wasn't illegal at the time, but it wasn't right. And Vince claimed this was many years ago, so nobody really knew too much about it, which is total BS. You know, Vince was the brainchild of the World Bodybuilding Federation. He and Warrior both were huge bodybuilding buffs. I don't buy for a second that he was ignorant about what HGH was. But still, it was refreshing to hear them being somewhat honest about this stuff on their own programming. It was actually pretty incredible to be sitting here watching this. And Warrior even said here, the government was cracking down on WWE, and so WWE all of a sudden became a lot more strict about things when it came to drug testing and stuff like that, and cracking down. And, you know, that was when they suspended Warrior and Davey Boy. Actually, I think he got fired, because Bulldog ended up in WCW a few months later, which tells you how strict WCW was at the time when it came to their own steroid policy. Covered Warrior's debut in WCW is Halloween Havoc debacle with Hogan, which Hogan admits here was all his fault. He took the blame for it being so bad. They even showed him trying to set that flash paper on fire to throw a fireball at Warrior. That's when it wouldn't light. And then finally it did light, but Hogan ended up singeing his own eyebrow. I think all the hair on Hogan's face got singed off from that fireball. The whole thing was just a complete disaster. There's a mixture of footage on here from his new DVD that just came out at the beginning of the month, and new comments, plus all the footage of him from WrestleMania week. But the DVD stuff was very limited, so I've had people ask me, well, is it just a rehash of the new DVD that came out? There is some footage of him sitting, I guess, in front of a fireplace in his home. That was from the DVD, but it's very, very limited. It's mostly all new, never-before-seen stuff. So if you're worried that it's just a rehash of the DVD, it's not. It's really not. It's mostly made up of good stuff. Yeah, the documentary was the story that Warrior always wanted to be told, and obviously, with his dying, they rushed it out because the original plan here was for this to be a DVD. This was going to be a DVD documentary many months down the road with all the WrestleMania week stuff and the Hall of Fame stuff, and plans changed when he died. So they rushed this thing out, and when you consider how quickly they had to turn this around, it's unbelievable how awesome this thing turned out to be. Because this doesn't come off as a rush job at all. I mean, they go in depth on stuff that I wouldn't even expect them to. And they didn't have to. We have footage of Warrior at Stanford a few weeks before WrestleMania, meeting all the executives. They were going over plans for his brand, I guess, moving forward. He reunites with Triple H in Triple H's office, and pretty cool moment, actually. Triple H is like a big screen in his office that is a direct video link to the Performance Center down in Orlando. So at any moment when somebody's training in the ring or doing something, cutting a promo, there's a direct video link to Triple H's office and he can just watch it. So he's showing Warrior all this stuff. Warrior was in another executive's office being shown all the different Warrior designs and the different logos they were planning to market. And in the background, if you paid attention, there was a Royal Rumble pay-per-view poster. It was either from this year or last year, with a yellow post-it note placed over CM Punk's face. I thought that was hilarious. And petty, but mostly hilarious. So then it really gets into the emotional stuff. Warrior backstage at rehearsals for the Hall of Fame, hugging Vince McMahon, kind of reuniting with him on good terms, and making up with each other. You know, they kiss and make up here, and Warrior backstage with Linda McMahon, who he personally selected to induct him, and Warrior's telling stories about how he used to be over at the McMahon's house in Connecticut, and he was very close with Shane. Him and Shane would wrestle around. Shane would attack him, and he would kind of swat him away. It's a shame they couldn't get Shane in to offer some comments, because you got the impression watching this that him and Shane at one time, you know, before things went to hell, were actually pretty close. They show Warrior backstage with his two little girls. And to me, maybe the most emotional part of the whole DVD, besides the ending, obviously, is Vince mentioned that he had always thought of the Warrior as the little engine that could, because he never took no for an answer. All the battles they had and everything, never took no for an answer. So they must have had a conversation many, many years ago where Vince told him that. He said, listen, you're like the little engine that could. And I don't think it was ever spoken of ever again. But we have a scene here where Warrior is backstage at the Hall of Fame, and he's got a copy of the little engine that could. And he signs it with a personal message that he reads out loud to Vince. And then he signs it, you know, always believe Warrior. So Vince is in, I guess it would be the gorilla position, as Warrior is about to go out for his speech, and Warrior hands him the book, and Vince has this puzzled look on his face, and he looks down, and he realizes what it is, and he just starts laughing, and it's like he, you know, he can't believe it. And Warrior says, you know, you told me something many years ago, and, you know, I just wanted you to remember, or wanted you to know that I remembered that. So then they cut back to Vince in studio making comments, and Vince says, you know, it shows that he was actually listening all along. And that's when Vince loses it, and it's very rare that you see Vince McMahon cry or Vince McMahon well up. I mean, it's happened before, but not very often, but this was as close as I've ever seen to Vince McMahon in tears. And I'm not talking about that segment on Raw a couple years ago where, remember he was wearing the pink suit jacket? He was in the ring with Triple H, and Triple H said, you know, you're out of power, and Vince started crying in the ring. You know, that was all for show, but this was legit, and this was tough to watch. And Vince's eyes are all red and welled up with tears, and he says, you don't know what you have until you don't have it. So, clearly, with all the past stuff between them, you know, it's just water under the bridge, and then this happens, and it's you know, you look back, and it's almost the timing is just so eerie. That after 18 years of all the squabbling and the legal battles and the nastiness and the self-destruction DVD and everything else, they finally put all that stuff to bed, and then the guy dies. And you could see it had a real impact on Vince McMahon. The last photo with Vince and Warrior is showed, and Stephanie had tweeted it out actually that night on Raw when Warrior came out. And they say on the special here that Warrior requested it. He said, listen, he asked if somebody could take a photo of him and Vince before he left. And Vince says that may have been the last photo Warrior ever took. I don't think it was. They were fans who had tweeted photos with Warrior the day he died at the airport. But that was the last photo of Vince and Warrior together. And again, very, very emotional. Triple H talks about how he got a text from his assistant who was contacted by Dana, Warrior's wife, telling her that he had died, and Triple H was just, you know, blown away by it. And then he realized that he had to tell Vince. So then Triple H got very emotional, and, you know, at the end of the DVD, Sting says something that I said last week, which is, you look at the sequence and the timeline of events here and how everything went down that last weekend, and it was almost prophetic. You know, Sting says it was almost prophetic, like it was meant to be. It was meant to happen this way. And, That pretty much is the crux of the DVD. I mean, there's a lot of other really cool footage in there. I even left out some stuff. But well worth going out of your way to see. I can't rave about this enough. It's one of the best things that WWE has ever produced. I don't care if you're an Ultimate Warrior fan or not. You will enjoy this DVD. I mean, this was just awesome, awesome stuff. And I hope it does end up on USA Network or some, or television, wherever at some point. Because it's that good, and there's a lot of international fans who can't get the network, or people who just won't buy it for whatever reason. I don't know why they wouldn't at least sample it, especially for stuff like this. But hopefully it gets wider distribution at some point, because people need to see this, and I want to see them do more stuff like this. If this is a sign of stuff that we can expect on the network going forward, then I'm all in. You know, the Daniel Bryan stuff was okay. Like I said, it got a little too in character, a little too cute, I think. This just blew that out of the water. I mean, this was just awesome stuff. And it takes you on an emotional ride, that's for sure. I mean, there's a lot of moments that make you laugh and make you smile, but then you also, you know, those damn ninjas chopping onions, you know, they get to you at the end. And I didn't even mention the stuff about the Hogan deposition. You know, when they go into the self-destruction DVD and Warrior had filed litigation, and Hogan had made, I guess Hogan made some comments on the DVD going back to the SummerSlam stuff when Warrior got fired about finding out, supposedly, that Warrior was holding up Vince for more money and making a comment about how in the old days, you know, he would have broken the guy's legs. And they called Hogan in for a deposition. They actually had video footage from Hogan's deposition. I mean, that it blew my mind. I couldn't believe I was actually watching something that was produced by WWE. So, two thumbs up. I cannot recommend enough. It is absolutely worth going out of your way to see. The Legends Roundtable from Friday night, not so much, and I just sat there wondering, why would DiBiase, of all people, be asked to be a part of this? I know he worked with Warrior. Maybe they just wanted a more balanced perspective, but it wasn't like DiBiase was going to go on there and say anything really... I mean, how honest could the guy be? If he was going to be really honest, he'd be on there basically trashing the guy. He didn't do that. He took the high road. Although DiBiase did say one thing that kind of struck me, which is that Warrior... You know, Warrior's father left when he was 12 years old, so he didn't have that fatherly influence at a young age, really, all that much. And And then Warrior passing away from a heart attack, as his father did. And DiBiase said, you know, I can relate on some level because my dad died in the ring from a heart attack when I think DiBiase was 15. His father actually did pass away in the ring from a heart attack. So there's that connection there. I just thought it rang a little hollow having him, of all people, on there. I had just listened to a radio interview with DiBiase on YouTube from sometime within the last couple of years. And they asked him about the Warrior, and he actually talked about the Tokyo Dome match with Warrior in 1990, about 2 weeks after Warrior beat Hogan for the belt. They went to Japan, and they had a match. And DiBiase talked about that same match on the Legends Roundtable. And he made a comment on there. He said, well, it was a good match. But, you know, yet in this other interview, he said the opposite, and he was very angry because Warrior didn't really give him much, and then the referee gave them a cue to go home early, and so, you know, DiBiase felt disrespected because he had, you know, he had a reputation, he had something of a following in Japan from many years earlier, and here he was coming back to Japan, and basically he was almost like a job guy for the Warriors. So he didn't quite get into those details on the roundtable, but the documentary, absolutely go watch it. Speaking of the network, before I move on here, I know a lot of you wanted my thoughts on Legends House. Legends House, after, what, 2 years, 3 years, probably sitting in the can, finally aired the debut episode, and I liked it. I liked it for what it was. I mean, it was mostly just an introductory episode. Not a whole lot happened, so I think I'll form a better opinion of it going forward. You know, it's like Total Divas. When Total Divas first started, I watched the first episode, and I was like, all right, you know, this is kind of what I expected it to be, but let's give it a chance. And by the third episode, I gave up. So, and I have people telling me all the time, oh, you should go back and watch Total Divas now. It's really good. It's so much better. And I don't have time for it. Legends House, I'll make time for. The personalities, they've got Gene Okerlund, Tony Atlas, Pat Patterson, Hillbilly Jim, who just comes off as the nicest guy you will ever see. You know, you just want to go and share a beer with the guy. They've got, who else is on this show? Rowdy Piper is kind of like the main event guy there. Hacksaw Jim Duggan. Howard Finkel is on the show. It's like eight guys. And all living in a house out in California. Some are sharing a room with you. I think Duggan and Piper are roommates. And, you know, they're already building storylines around Piper. Doesn't, you know, he's not comfortable around other people and stuff like that. And Gary Busey, of all people, is the guest star on this episode. I don't know if he's a neighbor. You know, all I know is Gary Busey at one point, like, they're outside the house and they hear this giant gong. And I think Gene Okerlund was the one who said, he's like, I don't know where that gong is coming from. I thought maybe Mr. Fuji was nearby. So, you know, they go and they find Gary Busey. And Gary Busey has them sit in a circle and they meditate. Where the fuck Gary Busey came from, I don't know. I don't remember if they mentioned if he lived in the neighborhood or if they flew him in from God knows where, from what planet he's from. But that was interesting. So, yeah, they meet the neighbors and stuff like that. I enjoyed it. I thought it was a little goofy, but it was fun. It was fine. And I will be watching next week. So that's my review of Legends House. There's not really a whole lot to say. There wasn't a lot that happened. You know, they played some tennis. They tried cooking some cabbage rolls that weren't ready in time. You know, there was one, I will say this, there was one funny moment where Pat Patterson, oh, and Jimmy Hart is also on the show, who never ages, by the way. Jimmy Hart's 70 years old. He looks the same as he did 30 years ago. But Jimmy Hart and Pat Patterson went to the supermarket to get some stuff to make dinner. And Patterson goes to get meat from the deli counter. And he's, you know, he's ordering the meat, and the kid behind the counter, you know, is collecting the stuff, and Patterson makes a comment. It's something to the effect of, so, you like meat, huh? I just, like, the kid has no idea, you know. It's just right over his head. But, you know, anybody who knows Pat Patterson knows, ha-ha, you know, very funny. That was Legends House. I will be watching next Thursday. That's my new Thursday night routine. Legends House leads right into NXT. And if I'm not too tired, I'll start on Impact. I haven't even watched Impact on a Thursday night in so long. I usually end up just watching it on Friday or Saturday. I just feel like if I go from Legends House to NXT to 2 hours of Impact, I just want to shoot myself. So I think I'm going to stick to this pattern of Legends House and NXT, and I'll just save Impact for a different day. Why don't we get into Raw first, since we're already over half an hour into this show. Raw this past Monday night was an Ultimate Warrior tribute show. They opened with all the wrestlers out on stage, including Vince McMahon, who was front and center. Jerry Lawler was off camera, probably at ringside, on the microphone, narrating the whole thing. They had an awesome video package set to clips from the Warrior's career, all of his matches. And then they went into a 10-bell salute, which was very classy. I thought it was overall a very classy tribute on their part. Quite the departure from how they treated Warrior with that whole DVD fiasco a decade ago. From then to now is quite the change in attitude. And so then they played Warrior's music. They had handed out Ultimate Warrior masks to all the fans in the crowd. So I guess in the arena, Lawler had instructed everybody to put their masks on before they went on the air. So there were a bunch of people wearing Warrior masks. And then throughout the night, they just interspersed clips from various Warrior matches, him beating Honky Tonk Man at SummerSlam in 30 seconds, the match with Hogan at WrestleMania 6, his cage match for the world title with Rick Rude, which may have been their final match at SummerSlam 1990. You know, a lot of key stuff and key moments from Warrior's career. You know, people say that Warrior's best match was with either Hogan or Savage. I think Warrior's best match was the WrestleMania 7 match with Savage, and probably 6 with Hogan would be number 2. But, you know, when I think best opponent of the Ultimate Warriors, even though they didn't necessarily have the best match of Warrior's career, I keep thinking of Rick Rude. I just think the stuff with Rude and Warrior was really good, largely due to Rick Rude, you know, if we're being honest here. But the matches they had, mainly, and especially that match at SummerSlam in 89, I wasn't really a huge fan of their WrestleMania 5 match, but the rematch at SummerSlam, they had a match on Saturday night's main event in July of 1990 that then led into the cage match that we saw clips of Monday night from SummerSlam. They had a lot of really good matches. And I thought Warrior was, or rather Rude, was just the perfect opponent for the Warriors. So he would probably be, I think, his best adversary over the years. So anyway, that was all the Warrior tribute stuff. The other big story from Raw Monday night was the return of Evolution, which is sure to piss off all the natural selection folks out there. And the start of the Intercontinental title tournament to crown a new number one contender for Big E to lose to at Extreme Rules. Daniel Bryan and Brie Bella were on their honeymoon, so they were off the show, which I think is good. We don't need the champion on every single show. I'd be fine if they held him off more often, and that goes for all the top guys, not just the champion. You know, they don't need to be on TV every single week. I'm not saying they should have a Brock Lesnar schedule where they show up 3 times a year, but there's a reason when Brock goes away and then comes back, he feels more special. That's all I'm going to say. And to go back to the Warrior stuff just for one quick second, I mentioned the 10-bell salute, you know, and I couldn't help but think when that was over, it's kind of sickening to me that Randy Savage never got a 10-bell salute. I know it's not a big deal, but, you know, if you're a fan of these guys and you grew up on a lot of these guys, you know, there's certain guys who, you know, when they pass away, they're a big enough name or they're important enough to wrestling or to that company where they warrant that kind of treatment, a tribute show, 10-bell salute, whatever. You know, and Warrior got the 10-bell salute, and rightfully so, because he was one of the biggest stars in the history of that company. And right now it's all Warrior all the time. You know, they're paying tribute to him, and maybe they even feel a little bit bad to some degree about the way they treated him many years ago with that DVD. I mean, maybe that plays into it a little bit. But Savage deserved the same treatment, and he never got, you know, he got a video, but I feel in a lot of ways he's kind of been brushed under the rug. I mean, now they're marketing the shit out of the guy. I couldn't believe how much Macho Man merchandise there was in that superstore over WrestleMania weekend. You know, action figures, t-shirts, Macho Madness, I mean, there's a lot of Macho Man stuff. Yeah, so now they can make a lot of money off it. But, I don't know, it just bothers me that he never got the same treatment from the company. Rob Van Dam beat Alberto Del Rio in the opening round match of the Intercontinental Tournament. This was fun to watch, largely because these guys kill each other every time they're in the ring together. I think they had at least one match before RVD took his sabbatical. So I don't think this was the first time they've wrestled. But when these guys are in there, they're stiff as hell. It just looks like they're killing each other. I love it. A little sloppy, but when it was over, it felt like they had been in a real fight. So I like that. We had the corniest commercial in the history of all mankind with Sheamus and Big E in their gear, hawking their action figures in the middle of a Toys R Us. What adult male would cheer for either of these men after this? Please, raise your hand. I can't think of any. Backstage, Triple H tried to explain to Orton and Batista that together, nobody can stop them. But they blew him off. They said, listen, the Shield is your problem. Leave us out of it. And they left. And Stephanie then told Triple H, don't worry, I've got an idea. And by the time the show is over, it was never explained what that idea was. So I have to think that we'll find out maybe this week on TV. If her idea was to send the Shield out there later on to beat up Orton and Batista, which they did, why the Shield would take orders from Stephanie, I have no idea. So to me, that can't be it. There's got to be another explanation for that. Rybacksel beat the Rhodes Brothers. All the fire from that team, Cody and Goldust. They're still, you know, when they're in there, they're great. But, I mean, the fire and everything that that team had going for them, just gone. You know, a few months ago, they were one of the hottest acts in the company. It's like, what happened? What happened? Paige and Alicia Fox had a match. Good match. Alicia was the aggressor, which is exactly how I like it. She took most of the match, punking out the rookie, but Paige got her in that sweet scorpion crosslock for the tap out. My new favorite submission in WWE. I'm telling you, between her and Emma, the women have far more devastating-looking submission finishers than the men do. You know, Rusev has a glorified camel clutch. John Cena has the STF, which looks about as painful as getting hit in the face with a cotton ball. Whoever's training these women needs to give the men a few tips. With AJ Lee taking time off, it's going to be Paige and Tamina for the title at Extreme Rules. That is your Divas Championship match. Batista and Orton against the Usos broke down into another no contest. This time the Shield ran out to attack Ortista. That's my name for them, Batista and Orton. Ortista. Roman Reigns caught Big Dave with a Superman punch. Dave sold it like death. That was great. Cesaro and Mark Henry. In an intercontinental match, Heyman introduced Cesaro to no music, which someone on Twitter cleverly pointed out must mean that Cesaro not only won the Andre the Giant trophy, but he inherited Andre's theme music as well. A lot of people liked this. They said, it's old school, it's a throwback, you know, to another era. I don't like it. Hopefully it's just a case where they turned him so quickly they didn't have music ready for him, and they're working on that right now. I wish there was a way for him to keep the Real American theme song and just give Swagger new music, because Cesaro was over with that music. You know, people were humming it on his way to the ring. You know, I noticed that in New Orleans, the post-WrestleMania Raw. I mean, they were singing. They were humming his theme music. It has no words, but they were singing his theme music on the way down to the ring. You know, I guess if the idea is that he's a heel now, being that he's aligned with Heyman, and I'm not sure that it is. I mean, people despise Paul Heyman, but that doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, we're supposed to boo Cesaro because all of a sudden he's a heel. But if that's the idea, you know, then I guess you don't want people singing the guy's theme song. I get that. I just don't know why you had a good thing going. Why ruin it? I like the Cesaro-Heyman pairing. But I would have, and maybe they're going to do this, I would treat it with Heyman's Heyman. Okay, people are going to boo him. He could be a dick and all that kind of stuff. But it's okay to have somebody like Heyman manage a guy who's not going to act and behave like a heel. I think Cesaro should just keep doing his thing. If he's over, let him be over. There's nothing wrong with Paul Heyman managing a bad guy like Brock Lesnar and managing a guy that the people like. It's a little weird, but, you know, times change and evolve. I don't have a problem with that. I just feel like you had such a good thing going with Cesaro. I don't want to see them stall his momentum and ruin that. But anyway, this was all to build to him picking Mark Henry up for the neutralizer and getting the pin. I don't know. I mean, given the fate that usually befalls the holder of that title, I'm not sure I want Cesaro anywhere near it, even though he's probably going to win the whole thing. You know, when I said the same thing on Twitter, somebody wrote me. They said, well, you know, would you rather it continue to be held by Big E and not mean anything? And that, I mean, it just, I'm not getting on the person, just that comment. It pissed me off so much. It's like, no, actually, I would rather they push their champion in the first place. How's that for a fucking idea? Wouldn't that be something? Like it's Big E's fault. that all of a sudden the Intercontinental title means nothing again. You know, it's like the guy's got that gold thing around his waist. Maybe we should, you know, do something with him. What a novel idea. And people get upset when they say WWE is just trying to add prestige to the title, and I laugh at them in response. They get angry. Like, why are you laughing? They're trying. They're trying to make it mean something. I've been doing this show for over 6 years now. Almost six and a half, okay? I would love for somebody to go back over the previous 323 episodes that I have done and count the number of times that this has happened before, okay? Where it looks like they're actually going to do something with the Intercontinental title, and they sucker me in, and we're all optimistic, and then a few weeks later, like a child who gets distracted by a lightning bug, okay, it's like, ooh, look at that, and they lose interest, and we're right back to where we were before. Too many times. I would love for that title to mean something again, okay? I love the Intercontinental title. I loved it when I was a kid. I love the way it looks. It's great, okay? Even Big E, when he first won the title, I don't even remember who he beat for it. I can't even remember. But when he first won it, they were pushing the dude, okay? So it looked like maybe he'll actually help elevate the title to mean something. He would come out for a title defense, and they would do the championship intros, where both guys, they would wait until they're in the ring, and then they would do the intros, and they would make it feel like, oh, this is a big-time match. Like, they were doing all the right things at first when Big E won the belt. And you read stories, oh, Big E's good friends with John Cena, so maybe that helps a little bit. You know, he's seen his buddy. You know, it looked like maybe they were actually going to do something. And then all of a sudden, Big E just disappeared from TV for like a month or more. And then he lost half his name. You know, Dean Ambrose. Look at Dean Ambrose. Dean Ambrose is about to set the all-time record for consecutive days as the United States champion in WWE. Okay, I was just reading something about this before. 342 days is the record set by MVP. So he's about a week away from that, about 7 days. He's going to tie, and then he's going to break it. Sounds impressive, right? Oh, yeah, very impressive. It's easy to do when you never defend the damn thing. You know, they're doing this tournament. The script for Raw last Monday leaked after the show was over. They had a match planned originally between Big E and Titus O'Neil. I don't know if it was for the title or not. Probably non-title. And the match never happened. Okay, the script, obviously plans changed. It looks like the tournament was a last-minute decision. This was not something that they thought of, you know, days in advance. Like, you know what? Why don't we build the prestige of this title? No, it looks like this was a last-minute change. And for what it's worth, in the script, Titus mentions Cesaro being the number one contender. So that may be a little spoiler as to who's winning the whole thing. But I wish people wouldn't get so upset when I make comments like that, whether it's here, on Twitter, or wherever. You know, excuse me for not having a whole lot of faith that, you know, after a few weeks, they're going to keep building this title up like it actually means something. They talk about the prestigious Intercontinental title, and I snicker. I laugh every time they say that on commentary. Prestigious, really? You would never know it by watching TV, especially when the champion goes out there, Big E, in different matches, he gets pinned. Didn't Big E get pinned a whole bunch of times by Del Rio, who can't win a fucking match to save his life these days? Shouldn't that make Del Rio the number one contender for the title? Whatever happened to that? Why would you send the champion out there to get beat on TV? Doesn't make any sense. Anyway, Sheamus beat Jack Swagger in the next IC tournament match. Swagger hurt Sheamus' leg, which was he was selling big time when the match was over. So that may play into why he loses in the next round, if he loses in the next round. Damian Sandow held something of a protest in the middle of the ring. He was on the microphone saying he is the most deserving man in WWE. Big Show came out for their match. He took a break in the corner. Let Sandow continue to rant. I deserve it. I deserve it, he said. I could see exactly where this was going, what the punchline to this whole thing was going to be. And sure enough, Big Show, he got up in Big Show's face, and Big Show ended up giving him the knockout punch, and then he left. And I waited for the announcers to use the punchline. The punchline being, well, he said he deserved it. He got what he deserved. And they never fucking used that line. Just aggravated me so much. I figured that's what the whole thing was building up to, and the announcers never said anything about it. I think JBL made a comment, not using those words, though. And it was like, that was the whole point of the segment, and they never said it. What a waste of time. This whole thing was a waste of time. Sandow, I mean, you know, what more can be said? This poor guy. This next segment was John Cena at his worst. The Wyatts came out, and Bray Wyatt cut a promo in the dark on John Cena before Cena made his way out on stage. And from there, it was the Comedy Hour with John Cena. And what makes this so bad is that it's never funny. I never laugh at any of Cena's punchlines. Never. And we have to sit there and listen to the announcers snorting in the background. They're losing their shit. They're laughing so much in the background. That phony, fake laughter that is so infuriating. You know, if the point of this segment was to get me to want to see Cena's heart ripped out of his chest and used as a flotation device, mission accomplished, okay? But they did the old, let's show a Photoshop picture of the heel on the Titantron, which has been done to death. You know, Jericho invented that, by the way. Just ask him, he'll tell you. He invented everything. But no, I mean, Jericho was the best one. He did it back in the day with Benoit on SmackDown. I still remember that to this day. He put photos up on the SmackDown screen of, it was like a Dr. Seuss story that he was reciting with Benoit in it, and they would show Benoit on a boat, Benoit with a goat. And it was actually really funny. You know, every time they've done it since, it just hasn't been as funny. And Cena said he found a picture of Sister Abigail, and he showed a photo of Bray Wyatt dressed as a woman. This was horrendous. Horrendous, this was. And Wyatt kind of saved it by pointing out the fact that every time Cena feels threatened, he has to resort to jokes. And then suddenly John Cena got serious. So the comedy here was a means to an end. They did it on purpose. But I don't care. It still irritates the shit out of me when he does it. And Cena challenged him to a steel cage match at Extreme Rules, and Bray accepted, so I guess he can get his win back now. But this segment was just so infuriating. I just, when he comes out and does that corny comedy crap, whether there's a point to it or not, it's horrible television. It's just terrible, and it's not funny. And like I said, that's what makes it so bad. If he was actually funny, if I sat there, even though I wanted so badly to hate this segment, but he says something that makes me chuckle, it's like, all right. That was kind of funny. I'll give him that. Never happens. It's just like you heard the crickets for Evolution at the beginning of the show, right? That's exactly what it's like. I mean, you have the little kids in the crowd. You know, they laugh, but they don't know any better. It's 5-year-old humor. Backstage, Stephanie chewed out corporate Kane for being a failure. Well, he really has. This gimmick. I had high hopes for Libertarian Kane, and they have not lived up to my expectations. She said she wanted the monster back. Kane then grabbed his old mask out of the glass case that's been sitting in Stephanie's office for a few weeks now and said that he would send Daniel Bryan to the depths of hell. And if you've been watching Raw for at least 2 years now, you'd know the depths of hell are really just under the ring. Kane once tried to drag Zack Ryder down there. It was riveting television. So they're teasing Bryan versus Kane on Raw this Monday. My guess is that we'll end up getting it at the pay-per-view or special event, whatever the hell they're calling it now. That's a match I don't need to see, especially since Bryan's already beaten Kane clean and gotten his revenge back on main event last month. I think it may have been the first live main event they promoted on the network. It was Bryan versus Kane. I watched that match. It wasn't very good. And Bryan beat him. But I guess they need a challenger for him, and Bray Wyatt's all tied up with Rodney Danger Cena, so we get Kane. Bad News Barrett beat Dolph Ziggler with the Bullhammer Elbow in an excellent match to advance in the Intercontinental Title Tournament, so it'll be Barrett and Sheamus. And with them and Cesaro, we've got quite the European influence in this tournament. They put these guys in the death spot on a 3-hour show, which is that 10:30 to 10:40-ish quarter. And to their credit, they got the crowd into it. They were hanging on every near fall, even got a This Is Awesome chant at one point. That's not an easy thing to do. After the match, Barrett got on the mic and proclaimed, "I'm afraid I've got some bad news," which is that he would be the next Intercontinental Champion. And really, he's probably right. Remember how great that last IC title run was for him? Exactly. Main event was The Shield, 3-on-11, against Del Rio, Swagger, Titus, Fandango, Rybacksel, 3MB, Bad News Barrett, and Alexander Rusev. Is that 11? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. That's 10. I think I'm missing somebody. Rusev really should have been kept apart from these guys and out of this match. I don't know why he was out there. He had a squash earlier in the show against, I think it was Xavier Woods, and then R-Truth ran out because he wouldn't let go of the hold at the end. So they may be building something between the two of them, but Rusev should not have been out here for this. I hate these handicap matches. It broke down after a few minutes when the Shield ran wild. A couple of dives onto the heels on the outside. Reigns went wild. Then they all got ganged up on. And things look bleak for the Hounds of Justice. Suddenly we hear Evolution's old theme music, and out walks Triple H, Randy Orton, and Batista. And the lack of crowd reaction in Birmingham was stunning. You would think, I mean, Evolution was a pretty big deal back in the day, and it really wasn't that long ago. You know, it was about a decade, I guess, but it's not like we're going back to the days of the Four Horsemen or, you know, even the NWO at this point is almost 20 years old. But you would never know that Evolution was anything special when these guys walked out. I know they're heels, but you would expect some kind of reaction, some kind of cheers, and it really wasn't there. So that lack of crowd reaction was quite noticeable. Maybe it's a one-week thing. You know, had this happened in Chicago or New York or even in New Orleans. I mean, if this happened last week in New Orleans, I mean, they would have gotten a standing ovation. So it maybe just depends on the city that you're in. They beat the crap out of the Shield. Reigns ate an RKO from Orton and a Batista bomb from Big Dave, as did Seth Rollins. Triple H got on the mic, but he noticed Roman Reigns trying to get back to his feet. He taunted him for a little bit, delivered a pedigree. So Evolution is officially back together, save for the old man who thinks Mick Foley overstayed his welcome in the wrestling business. I still can't get over that comment. He said that with the guy sitting right next to him. It's like, what an asshole. And he said it with a straight face, too, of all the guys in the world to be talking about people who don't know when to quit. I hope they keep him away from this. I have less than zero interest in seeing Ric Flair involved in this storyline. I dig an Evolution vs. Shield match, which will headline Extreme Rules May 4th. That is the main event that's been announced. I still think holding two titles should qualify you to be headlining these shows, but I am more interested in Shield vs. Evolution than I am Kane and Bryan, so it's on them. It's on WWE to come up with better opponents for the guy going forward. I think Bray Wyatt would make a good one since, you know, once he finishes up his story with Cena. Remember, Wyatt's got a clean win over the champion at Royal Rumble this year. That has to play into things at some point, you would think. So that was Raw from Monday night. WWE announced the number of pay-per-view buys, domestic buys, for WrestleMania this year. An early estimate, you should put a little asterisk next to it, because in the past when they've announced the number this early, more often than not, that number goes down. And so that, you know, what they announced was that WrestleMania this year got nearly 400,000 domestic buys on pay-per-view, which sounds very impressive, but they said nearly 400,000, so that can mean anything. That can mean 380, that can mean 350. I don't think it means 400, but it's probably pretty close. And then a few months down the road, if they revise that number down even more, it may not seem so impressive. But when you have 667,000 people who so far have subscribed to your network and who presumably did so for WrestleMania, and most of those 667,000 probably watch WrestleMania, not all of them, but most of them probably did. You couple that with almost 400,000, you got almost a million people right there. And that doesn't count international. So that is pretty impressive. I still don't see how they're pulling another 400,000 subscribers to get to a million by the end of the year without there being another WrestleMania-type event between now and then. They may have live specials, you know, and they'll have SummerSlam, which is kind of a big deal still, but they have nothing on the agenda, on the schedule, between now and December 31st, that's going to come anywhere close to being as big as WrestleMania. WrestleMania was the big event. That was the big deal. So where these 400,000 people are coming from between now and December, I would love to know. You know, maybe they'll surprise me and they'll announce at the end of the year that they hit a million. That's what their goal is. Their goal has always been to hit 1 million subscribers by the end of the year. And I just don't see how that's going to happen. They will hit a million. I don't doubt that they're going to hit a million. I just don't think it's going to happen before the end of the year.
The
was a pretty bland episode of NXT this week. It was highlighted by a great backstage interview with the new Undisputed Women's Champion, Paige. They didn't call her that, but she's walking around with both belts now, so that's basically what she is. We had Aiden English pinning Colin Cassidy with a handful of tights. This is weird to me. You know, Cassidy is a 7-foot guy, and he can't seem to buy a win over Aiden English in this feud. You know, their booking of Cassidy is just so odd to me. He's gotten better. He gets a great response from the crowd, the soft chant and all that kind of stuff. But, boy, Enzo Amore cannot come back soon enough. I read that he's finally back training after his broken leg. So here's hoping he's back on TV soon for Colin Cassidy's sake, if nothing else. Backstage, Devin Taylor introduced Tyler Breeze, who said he was only there to add a bit of gorgeous to the show. And he walked off, and he was never seen again. I will take a little bit of Breeze over no Breeze at all. So this was fine. Then we got Tom Phillips interviewing Paige backstage at a recent show. She had both titles on her shoulders. Said it still doesn't feel real to her. Her dream has been fulfilled, she said. I hope not. She's only 21 years old. Where the hell does she go from here if her dream has already been fulfilled? I mean, I guess that's the problem when you have somebody that young and you give them everything at once. She said when she got backstage after winning the Divas title from AJ, the other Divas were all smiles. They were hugging her and congratulating her. They even showed some footage of that when she came through the curtain. But what they didn't realize is that they were all mic'd up and she could hear what they were saying about her behind her back when they went to go walk away. So she looks forward to Sasha Banks and Charlotte and AJ and all the other women trying to take those titles away from her. She was very poised during this promo, and she's only 21, so, you know, she's only going to get better. She's already very good. You have guys in their 30s who can't cut promos this smooth, so she's more than ready for the main roster. But, yeah, you always have to worry if it's too much too soon. The one other thing I got out of this promo was I thought maybe with her winning the Divas title that they would put the women's title up in a tournament or something. Kind of like Warrior. When he beat Hogan for the belt back at WrestleMania 6, he had to give up the Intercontinental belt. It doesn't seem like they're doing that. It seems like she's going to defend both going forward. Camacho and Oliver Gray in Oliver Gray's first match back in over a year after surgery on his ACL. Camacho, after last week, he interrupted Oliver Gray's promo. He's wearing a suit. He was looking very dapper. This week, came out dressed like a gangbanger because I guess that's his gimmick. He's the Tongan Mexican. But they don't tell you he's Tongan and was born in Florida. Shockingly, he beat Oliver Gray 2 minutes, running Samoan drop. So to put this in perspective here, the Tongan, billed as a Mexican, wins with a Samoan drop. This poor guy's got an identity crisis going on. He was bad-mouthing Adam Rose on his way back up the ramp, so I guess they're building to another match between the two of them. Very weird to have Oliver's, you know, big return end up in a loss, his first match back to a guy who never wins. But got to pay those dues, I guess. Bo Dallas was backstage with a microphone. Devin Taylor was holding the microphone, but I don't even know why she's there. She's pretty bad. It really makes me appreciate Renee Young that much more because she had infinitely more charisma for doing the same exact basic job, which is just standing there. You ask a stupid question, and then you awkwardly stare at the wrestler when he walks away. That's the formula. That's the backstage interviewer formula 101 in WWE. Ask a stupid question, you stand there, and then you look at the camera for far too long before they cut to commercial. That's what happens. You know, you could put a cardboard cutout out there with a tape recorder and pretty much get the same effect. So Bo said he understands why nobody came to the ring when he tried to occupy NXT last week. His Bo Leavers didn't want to do anything unlawful and get thrown in the pokey. He said the Bo movement will never die, and he told Devin, don't stop Bo Leaving. So he'll be coming to Raw soon. They appear to be turning the Ascension babyface. That's the only conclusion I can come to here. The fans are getting more and more into their squash matches every single week. They don't even bill who their opponents are before the commercial break. They just say, coming up next, the Ascension kills two dudes. Stay tuned. And the victims this week were Cal Bishop, Wesley Blake, the Fall of Man on Blake. Pretty much it. You know the rest. Find these men real opponents, please. I'm begging you. Again, with Devin Taylor backstage, this time interviewing 2/3 of the BFFs, Sasha Banks and Charlotte. Sasha started to speak, Charlotte cut her off, said that giving her the reins of their group was an epic fail. So they're teasing a breakup there. Next week, it's going to be Charlotte and Sasha against Emma and a partner of her choosing. So Emma, apparently not done with NXT after all. Then we had CJ Parker and the great Kali. I was hoping their backstage segment from last week was just a bad dream, but it wasn't. By some miracle, the crowd did not shit on this match. In fact, they seemed to be rather into watching Kali chop the shit out of CJ Parker, and I gotta say, so was I. Kali was actually fine here in this match. He was still Kali, but you know, he knows what he can do, which isn't much, and he knows what he can't do, which is most everything else, and he does it well. Crowd started a global warming chant as Parker went to the top rope. He came off right into a Kali chop to the chest. And then he hit the Punjabi plunge, got the pin. Never have I been happier to see the great Kali win a match. We got a Sami Zayn interview backstage next week. It's going to be him and the Usos against Corey Graves and the Ascension, so that should be fun. We've got a new tag team on NXT, Ty Dillinger and Jason Jordan, who have appeared on NXT before, but as singles guys, pretty much enhancement guys. They haven't really done anything with them, so I guess they're putting them together as a tag team. God knows they need to build somebody for the Ascension, so I have no problem with that. Ty Dillinger is the former Sean Spears, or Gavin Spears from ECW, whatever name you're familiar with. He's used both before. They beat the team of Baron Corbin and Sawyer Fulton, so yes, this was a match with four guys the crowd did not know and didn't really care much about. They need to spice up those names a little bit. You know, some of my PayPal nicknames for you guys are far better than these names they're giving to some of these guys. You know, we've gotten far from the days of Eli Cottonwood and stuff like that. But, I mean, come on. You mean to tell me that you wouldn't want to see Pipe Layer Pog in action? Or Deathblow David Floyd? I mean, come on now. Main event was Brodus Clay against Adrian Neville. Guess they need some bodies to stick in there to give Neville some credibility. But when you can't put away Brodus Clay, I don't really know how effective that really is. I mean, how much credibility are you really building up if you can't beat Brodus Clay? But then again, Brodus is on the main roster and Neville isn't, so it kind of makes sense that he would have to struggle, but I mean, God, Brodus means less than nothing on that roster. They don't even put him on TV anymore unless you count main event, and even main event. I don't know, when was the last time he was really on main event? Kept the match semi-short, went about 6 minutes or so. Neville hung in there, built to a 450 attempt. Neville landed on his feet when Brodus moved out of the way. They moved outside the ring. Brodus body slammed him on the floor, tried to splash off the ring steps. Neville moved out of the way, so now both guys are down. Referee is counting, and Neville makes it back into the ring just in the nick of time, so he gets the count-out win. This feud is clearly not over, so we have not seen the last of Brodus Clay and Adrian Neville, but they really have to get him some challengers. And you know, if that's the idea with Brodus, that's fine. Let's kind of get this over with. I would still love, I mean, look, they had matches with Tyler Breeze and Adrian Neville before Neville won the belt. And I know Breeze has been built up a lot as mostly a comedy character, but one thing I liked that we saw from the last couple of Tyler Breeze matches is that he's got a more aggressive streak to him. There was a match, I don't remember with who, but there was a match he had recently where, you know, people took him seriously. He was in there, he got most of the offense, and I'd like to see them do more of that with Tyler Breeze, because I like Breeze. He's one of my favorites from NXT. At some point, though, they've got to transition him less comedy and more of a mean streak. And you could build him up as a contender for Neville's title. So hopefully that's the direction they're going in, and we can avoid any potential Adrian Neville, Corey Graves matches down the road, because those matches, those two guys just have no chemistry at all. But Tyler Breeze, and then after Breeze, Sami Zayn. And I think Sami Zayn and Neville could be a big feud down the road a few months for the NXT title. So hopefully they'll build in that direction. Check this out, guys. For you, the listeners of The Sound Off, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial so that you can check out their service. And it's a quality service. I wouldn't be mentioning it on my show if it wasn't. They have a bunch of wrestling books to choose from in audio form, including Lex Luger's book, Dusty Rhodes' book, Hulk Hogan's book is available with narration from the Hulkster himself. There's even one that chronicles the rise of the late Junkyard Dog in Mid-South, which sounds really interesting. You can choose any one of those free by trying Audible.com. If you commute to work, or if you like listening to things other than music at the gym, I know a lot of people listen to this podcast that way. It seems to me an audiobook would absolutely make sense. To get one, make sure you go to audibletrial.com/solomonster. It's another way to show your support for the Sound Dog, and you get something free in return. Can't beat that. Again, that's audibletrial.com/solomonster. Time for the Impact Report. To say that some of you were irked by TNA this week would be an understatement. Ben from Fresno wrote into the podcast. He said, "As a fan of your show, I hope you rip TNA so many new ones, the next time I watch Impact, it looks like I'm staring at a cheese grater." Wow. Well, sorry to disappoint Ben. I didn't think the show was that terrible. I've seen worse. Wasn't really that good, but I have seen Impacts that were far worse than this. They're trying with Eric Young, which is all you can really ask for. You know, he's the new champion. That's the direction they're going in. And they're trying to make him into a serious champion and not a joke. I don't know that people are going to buy it, but they're trying. They're trying to show a tougher side to him. And I really like the Sonata video package, which we'll get into. That was good. They've got Kurt Angle and Austin Aries both back on TV, which is good. We also had comedy on the show. Actual comedy. John Cena should take notes. Willow, in a video package, actually said that Eric Young was the greatest TNA champion of all time. If that isn't comedy gold, then I don't know what is. And by the way, they are now selling Willow umbrellas on ShopTNA.com for the low price of just $40. Yes, for those acid rain showers, I guess. $40 for an umbrella. I'll pay $40 only if I get to bash whoever scripted the opening segment of the show over the head with it. How about that? This was the worst part of the entire show was the opening. We had Delusional Dixie out to confront the new champion, Eric Young, in the ring. So, surprise, surprise, we have the heel authority figure coming out to confront the babyface champion and browbeat them. God, you know, it's not like we've ever seen that before on this show or any wrestling show. But we just went through the same fucking thing with Dixie and AJ. All of a sudden, we're doing this all over again, only in AJ Styles' place. It's now Eric Young. So Dixie comes out. She took credit for him being the champion, said that she could have fired him years ago, but didn't. And then she mentioned the beard. Took credit for Eric Young growing out his beard long before beards became fashionable in wrestling. And she looked straight into the camera, ignoring her own champion right next to her, like he didn't even mean anything. Just looked in the camera and took a jab at WWE that she should be getting royalty checks because they're using her intellectual property, I guess, with Daniel Bryan. This was so cringeworthy. Just so, so embarrassing. Why is this woman even on television? Didn't her team lose at Lockdown? MVP is the one running wrestling operations. Did I miss something? Was there any explanation as to why she disappeared for like 3 weeks and then suddenly reappeared on TV? So EY insulted her for a bit for some cheap pops. Then she threatened his wife, ODB, and Eric got up in her face when babyface Ray came to the ring. He led the crowd in a na-na-na chant and Dixie left. This segment sucked. There's no two ways about it. They were trying to make Eric Young, build him up, make him seem important, make him seem special. Putting him out there with Dixie Carter is not going to be effective. It's going to take a hell of a lot more than that to get people to take this guy seriously, which, you know, you can do it. You can do it, but this segment was not effective in that way. And the stuff with the beards, like, clearly she was out there trolling. You know, her character is a giant troll. That's what she is. She's delusional. That's why I call her Delusional Dixie. That's her whole character. And I think they say art imitates life, and I think there's some of that too. But the beard stuff, it was so bad. Oh, it was just terrible. I got goosebumps on my arms and my hair and the back of my neck was standing up. This was so minor league. Yeah, but that's the story of TNA right now. You know, they must think that having Dixie mention the beard stuff is like good heat. But it's not. It just makes them look like the bench warmers. That's what TNA was here. TNA came off as the bench warmers for WWE. And I'm going to say the same thing every time they insist on either outright mentioning WWE or kind of mentioning them without actually giving the initials. Okay, every time they do that, every time they pull that stunt, I'm going to say the exact same thing. Just pretend they don't exist. Pretend like you are, in fact, the number one wrestling promotion in the world, and WWE doesn't even exist. And just go about your business. Every single time you reference the competition, you look minor league. And you are minor league. But that shouldn't be the perception that people have of your company. At least try to pretend like you are the shit when it comes to professional wrestling. Instead, you go out there and you pretend that you are, in fact, shit. Don't be shit. Be the shit. We had Madison Rayne beating Velvet Sky in a street fight with a weak-looking spear. Backstage, Eric Young thanked Bully for his endorsement in the opening segment. Ray said, "No worries. I'm off to Rick's Cabaret in New York City." So he bailed. That's when Abyss walked up to EY, challenged him to a match for the title. Eric accepted and said, "I'll do you one better. Let's make it a Monsters Ball match." And so that was going to be our main event. MVP cut a promo in the ring, wondering why Samoa Joe wasn't returning his calls or his texts. Austin Aries found his way back to the Impact Zone. He's been found. He's actually been MIA since lockdown, so it was nice to finally see him back. He wanted to know why he had been left on the sidelines since the last pay-per-view. MVP said Aries screwed him over by aligning with Team Dixie, and he challenged him to a match right now. But Aries said he would do it next week in a wrestling match, because he knows better than to get into a fist fight with a convicted felon. I don't know. I don't recall Aries having any issues trading fists with Jeff Hardy, so I don't see why that would all of a sudden be a problem. The Wolves once again had the bromans beat. Tag team titles won, but the heels caused a cheap DQ to retain their belts. This time DJ Zima ran in, clobbered Eddie Edwards with his MacBook. Well, that's what heels do. You know, they get DQ'd to keep their titles, so that's fine. I like the bromans. I gotta say, you know, they've grown on me. I was not a fan of theirs at the beginning, especially Jesse. You know, Jesse, I think Jesse is really good in the role. And this is a guy that was pretty inexperienced when he first came into TNA, came from a reality show. That's what he was known for. You know, he's got the look, obviously, but I think he's had some noticeable improvement. And I think I like their act. Willow did an interview about EC3 and Rockstar Spud. I have no idea what he said. Something about dirty burgers giving him a stomach ache. I think Jeff's been eating out of the dumpster again. That reminds me, there's a video up on the TNA YouTube page. I was browsing through there because they have that Impact 365 content where wrestlers are supposed to film themselves and send it in, and it's reality. So one of the clips that they have up there is a video of Jeremy Borash, EC3, and Spud rocking out at a Lynyrd Skynyrd concert in Orlando. They're singing Freebird. And EC3, who is shirtless for some reason, is just completely out of his mind in this video. It's actually pretty entertaining. I like EC3. EC3 and Spud are actually really funny together. So if you didn't see that video, I wouldn't go out of my way to see it. But if you happen to stumble across it, it's like 2 minutes long. I thought it was funny. Willow beat EC3 and Spud in a handicap match when Willow pins Spud after a twist of fate. EC3 attacked Willow after the match was over. He was attempting to injure his knee when all of a sudden Kurt Angle's music hit. He ran down to the ring. He gave EC3 a German suplex before he bailed. Angle grabbed the mic. He looked dead in the camera and said he will not be done with EC3 until they take him out of the ring, not on a stretcher, but in a body bag. And Angle also spat all over the camera when he said this, so that was gross. But intense, very intense promo from Kurt Angle here. Pretty good stuff. Seiya Sonata video package. I mentioned at the beginning of this report that one of the things I liked about this show, if not maybe the thing I liked the most about this show, was the video package on Sonata. And I said the same thing many, many weeks ago when they did a video of Sonata backstage sitting down in the locker room with the great Muda, and they had subtitles on the screen. They were talking in Japanese. And Muda was just explaining why it's so important that Sonata represent the Japanese people, not just, you know, Muda's promotion, but the Japanese culture and the Japanese people, Japanese wrestling, by coming to TNA and being successful, becoming the X Division champion. And I just really liked it. I thought it was actually really cool. And they haven't really done anything with him since. I mean, he's had a few matches, but they did this video package. They showed him in his hotel room waking up at like 4:30 in the morning and then, you know, hitting the streets at 5 a.m. for a jog, and talked about how important it was for him to successfully defend his X Division title against Tigre Uno in their best of three series. I didn't even know he and Uno were having a best of three series. I mean, when the hell did that start? Apparently they've already had one match and Sonata won the first match. I mean, I missed Impact 2 weeks ago, the one before WrestleMania, so maybe the match happened on that show. I had no idea. Kenny King came out to do commentary for the Sonata Tigre Uno match, match number two. It was good while it lasted. It only went about 3 minutes, though. I mean, how good can it really be? You know, you got these two guys who can go out there, and they're used to working longer matches. They can have pretty kick-ass matches. You got a two-hour show. This is, you know, a best-of-three series for the X Division title, your second most important title in the company. And you give these guys 3 minutes. So they're not going to get over, you know, because you don't give them time to get over. You know, I'm sure a guy like Tigre Uno or Seiya Sonata, from what I've seen of them, you know, I'm not that familiar with their work in Mexico or in Japan, but from what I've seen, I bet you that if you gave these guys 10, 12 minutes out there to have a real kick-ass match, they would have the people on their feet clapping. But it's hard to do when you give them 3 minutes. So Uno won with a, I think it was a 450 corkscrew splash. I don't know if they gave it a name or not, but it was a pretty impressive-looking move. So they are now even at one win apiece. Bobby Roode beat Gunner in a tables match after James Storm ran down to distract Gunner up on the top rope. That gave Bobby Roode an opening to run over and throw him off. Gunner landed on the table, but he landed kind of weird. Now, Gunner's a big guy. If I had to take a guess, Gunner's got to be at least 265. He's a big dude. But he landed shoulder first. He kind of turned his body in a weird way and landed shoulder first. And the table didn't really break. It just sort of fell over. Part of it broke, but I guess that didn't count. It just looked really weird. It looked like a botch. So Roode picked him back up, set the table up, and gave him a TKO through the table for the decisive victory. And Bully Ray ran down to chase off the heels and make the save. I thought Bully was leaving to go to Rick's Cabaret. Apparently he had a change of heart. And I think they're having a tag team match next week. I think it's Bully and Gunner against Beer Money. By the way, whatever happened to those Nux videos? You know, they show them for like 2 weeks. Remember, he went back home. There was an arcade that got flooded after a storm. He was going to go see his old man about it. He hadn't seen his father in like 2 years. And then it hasn't been mentioned since. So I wonder if they just dropped the whole thing or what the hell's going on there. Eric Young and Abyss was your main event in a Monsters Ball match. Pretty good as far as brawls go. This reminded me of Shawn Michaels and Diesel. Not that it was as good of a match, but what I mean is, when Shawn beat Bret for the title of WrestleMania back in 96, his first title defense was against Diesel. It was that Good Friends, Better Enemies. It was a no-holds-barred match. And it was a really good match, maybe one of the best of Diesel's career. And the reason they did that match, and you could say the same thing about the match with Shawn and Mankind, which in my opinion was the match of the year in 1996. I remember WWE, I think at the Slammies, WWE had voted on the Iron Man match as match of the year in 96. And I always, even as a kid, I always disagreed with that. I always loved that Shawn Mankind match so much better. But I guess it was hurt because it had that DQ finish. But that match was just fucking awesome. But those two matches were used to kind of build this perception of Shawn as having a tough side. Like, they toughened him up. It was to show that Shawn could brawl with the big guys and he wasn't just a finesse guy and a flashy kind of guy. And I feel like that's what they were going for here with this Monsters Ball match. Eric Young has been largely booked as a comedy figure for most of his career in TNA. He's been in TNA for what, 8 years, 10 years? And look at the bulk of his career and you tell me, okay, he was a comedy character for much of that time. I mean, there may have been spots here and there where you were supposed to take him more seriously, but then he would go right back to being a comedy character. So they've got a lot of work to do if they want to convince people that this guy is a credible world champion, and I think that's what they were trying to do here. He took a lot of abuse in this match. He took a straight chokeslam bump right down on thumbtacks. It looked brutal. And I don't know if it's just because times have changed or it's been so long since I've seen a match like that or a bump like that, but I don't get any pleasure out of seeing that. You know, when it happened to Mankind in the Hell in a Cell match, you know, that was 98. That was a long time ago. And I see this guy in there now on a television show that's watched by like a million people. And TNA has, I mean, there have been few other times, I think, in the history of TNA where they have had less buzz around them. But this guy's going out there. He's taking bumps on thumbtacks. His back is all bleeding now. It's like, this guy's taking a beating for nothing. So that kind of bothered me. But, you know, he went all out here. You know, he took a lot of abuse. Abyss took a barbed wire board out from under the ring, slid it in. He ended up taking a back bump onto it. Eric Young came off the top with a Randy Savage elbow, got the pin. So a big win for Eric Young on the show. And a good end to the show. You know, Impact has been guilty before of having a really good main event. I think back to the match with Ken Anderson and Bully Ray when they culminated their feud. They had that casket match, and that was actually a pretty good match, and they had a feel-good moment with Anderson going over. And I remember when that was over, instead of ending the show, because that was the main event, the show ended with some backstage bullshit with Dixie and MVP. And TNA has done this time and time again, so this was nice that they actually ended the show on a high note, good main event. But enough with all the gimmick matches. Every single week, it's either a tables match, a monster's ball, a street fight, a cage match. It's always something for no reason. Monster's ball alone. I've now seen two monster's ball matches in the last month or so on Impact, both of which involved Eric Young and Abyss. So they need to tone that down. I don't know who's responsible for that. Actually, I have a pretty good idea about who's probably responsible for that, but they have to just tone that down. Ring of Honor. Got to mention this before we move on to the mailbag. Ring of Honor made a big announcement this week. They are coming to traditional pay-per-view for the very first time. Big step in company history. Some might say too little too late. Pay-per-view's dying. All of a sudden now Ring of Honor's coming to pay-per-view. I don't know that pay-per-view is dying. I don't really see any evidence of that, especially since WrestleMania did so well on pay-per-view when you had a network offering it for $10. But yeah, June 22nd is their Best in the World event from Nashville, Tennessee, the Nashville Fairgrounds, old TNA stomping grounds. A whole bunch of TNA talent on that show, including the champion Adam Cole, Unbreakable Michael Elgin, Matt Hardy, Kevin Steen, the Briscoe Brothers, Jay Lethal, and Playboy Cover Girl, and the first woman of ROH, Maria Kanellis, and many others. So that'll be on June 22nd, which is a Sunday, 8 Eastern, 5 Pacific, in HD. So this is a full-on Ring of Honor pay-per-view presentation, not iPay-per-view. Obviously, you hope that they don't have any issues on traditional pay-per-view, because that would be an even bigger disaster. The events are going for $24.95. That's for standard def, so I would think in high def it's going to be a little bit more. But good for them. That's a big step for ROH. I, myself, am looking forward to the ROH New Japan show at the Hammerstein Ballroom on May 17th. About a month away. Very much looking forward to that. And hopefully all goes smoothly with their pay-per-view presentation on the 22nd. And maybe they will be able to expand their audience. Maybe now it'll open up a whole new world of new viewers for them who will have access to Ring of Honor television who don't currently have access to Ring of Honor TV. So I hope it works out for them. If you have questions for the mailbag, you can email me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. You can send audio questions as well as attachments in MP3 format. Please remember to put your question in text form, in the body of an email, even if you do send in audio form, or else I probably won't use it. And please include your name and where you are from whenever you write in, and we actually have an audio question here to get us started.
Hey, Solid Monster, the Punkster 90 here. My question to you is, Stephanie McMahon just said at a business summit that the new logo for WWE is going to be the one used at on the network. Now, do you believe that we're in a transitional period away from the PG era into this new reality era, since we're seeing new talent showing up and NXT is being more emphasized and the launch of the network?
It does. It does feel a little bit like we're in a transition period here with the new guys coming up, the new logo. By the way, as he mentioned, the new logo is coming. It's coming right around SummerSlam time. Stephanie McMahon said as much in her own words at the presentation that there's like a business presentation that she had given, I think, the week before WrestleMania. It's up on the WWE corporate site. I don't know the timestamp. It's well over an hour. It's like 20 or 30 minutes in she makes the comments. So the new logo is coming. It is the network logo, like it or not, and I would suspect that at some point the WWE championship will change, and maybe at that point it'll just be one title. I hope so, because I don't think we need two belts. This audio question comes to us from Jason in the Bronx.
Hey, what's up, Solid Monster? The streak is over. But my question is about the man who ended it. Brock Lesnar has been a dominant beast since coming into the WWE, having decisive wins over guys like The Rock and even The Undertaker in past meetings. Hell, even Stone Cold Steve Austin would have met the same fate had he allowed it. So my question to you, Solid Monster, is do you think this was always the path for Brock Lesnar? Did Vince have this path laid out from the beginning? And if so, why was Vince dead set on having the guys that he had his company built on for the last 20 years being destroyed by this guy?
Well, I would hope it's because Vince gets it. He gets what Brock Lesnar is, you know, what Brock Lesnar is all about. Brock is, he's a special guy. There's not too many people that have come into that company who look like Brock, who can move around like Brock. He's a monster, you know. And if you go back to when he first came into WWE, I think the reason, to answer the second part of your question, why would Vince have this guy destroy all these other people who helped build his company for so long? Vince didn't know that Brock was going to leave and go try a career in the NFL and go to the UFC. They were building everything around Brock because they had long-term plans to make him one of the biggest guys in the history of that company. You know, he was going to be the dominant guy going forward. So that's why Brock came in, and within a few months, he won King of the Ring. 2 months later, he beat The Rock clean. Clean as a sheet in the middle of the ring for the championship at SummerSlam. And he had only been on television for like 5 months, 6 months. Probably not even that long. Then he went and he feuded with The Undertaker. How did that end? He beat The Undertaker in a Hell in a Cell match. Clean, in the middle. I remember that. Undertaker was just pouring blood in that match. It was one of the best Hell in a Cell matches, I think, in company history. So you got to be a special guy for, you know, The Undertaker to go in there with you, and he's going to put you over like that. Now, what was Undertaker's old catchphrase back then? I'll make you famous. Well, he made Brock Lesnar famous in that match. And Brock went on to have feuds with Big Show and Kurt Angle. He beat Angle in the main event of WrestleMania to win the belt. All these different people. He got a win over Hulk Hogan on television. He got a bear hug win over Hulk Hogan on SmackDown, like a week or two before SummerSlam. And I guess that kind of led to Hogan leaving the company a few months later, because Hogan, it was the understanding that Hogan would come back 2-3 months later at Survivor Series and beat Brock for the belt at Madison Square Garden, which is comical to look back on that now. I'm sure, I don't doubt for a second that Hogan would have wanted that. But these huge wins that Brock had when he was still a young guy, he was only 20-something years old at the time, 24, 25, whatever he was because they thought he was in it long term. They didn't know that, you know, less than 2 years later he would be out of the company. Had they known that, I'm sure they wouldn't have pushed him so hard. But as far as him breaking the streak, you know, was this laid out by Vince from the get-go? Was this the plan all along from the time Brock came back? No. No, I don't believe for a second that it was. You know, you read stories and you hear things. Is it true? Is it not true? You know, but by all accounts, I mean, it was Vince's decision for the streak to end, and it had everything to do with The Undertaker just being in the physical state that he's in and just not being able to go anymore. And I still think that we haven't seen The Undertaker's last match, but I admit I could be wrong. You know, that could very well end up being Undertaker's last match if he really is that bad off physically. You know, my guess would be that Vince saw that and he said, that's it. He made the call. And Undertaker had to go along with it. So I don't know that Undertaker would have wanted the streak to end that particular night, but he was like, all right, cool, let's do it. Maybe he knew. Maybe Undertaker knew. I mean, nobody knows his body better than he does. Only Undertaker really knows how bad off he really is with his knees and his hips and his back and everything else. You know, and there were rumors that he had a hip replacement many years ago, which I'm sure, look, if he hasn't had a hip replacement already, he's going to probably need two. There have been stories about The Undertaker needing hip replacements going back to the late 90s. And even Scott Hall. Scott Hall underwent surgery for, I think he had a hip replacement. And I remember Hall kind of let the cat out of the bag, I think maybe by accident. He was talking to, I don't know if it was the same doctor who had treated Undertaker before, but Scott Hall went and said something to the effect of, yeah, you know, I talked to the same doctor that did Taker's hip operation or hip replacement, and I don't know that he intended to kind of expose him like that, but he did, and that's not a shock to me at all, because there were rumors that during one of his sabbaticals a few years ago, he went away for several months, and It might have actually been the period before Undertaker came back in the summer. I think it was the summer of 2010. Remember when Undertaker was in a vegetative state? It was like in May over Memorial Day, the Memorial Day holiday or something. The storyline was that Undertaker was in a vegetative state. Kane found him that way. We found out later on that it was Kane who attacked his brother. When Undertaker came back for that feud with Kane, I want to say the latter part of 2010, and I'm pretty sure I said the same thing back then, he didn't look like the same guy that we had seen retire Shawn Michaels at WrestleMania. Something happened in that break between the Mania match with Shawn in Phoenix and his comeback feud with Kane for the world title. That's when Undertaker lost, I think, 3 straight pay-per-view matches or something like that to Kane, which was unheard of, because it was always Undertaker beating Kane in their feud over the years. But here, he kind of paid it forward, I guess, and Kane got these big wins over Undertaker. Paul Bearer came back. He turned on the Undertaker. All of those matches were pretty bad. And Undertaker just did not look physically in the ring like the same person. Now, he did come back later. He had some really good WrestleMania matches against Triple H. It's not like he never had another good match. But I always thought, like, something happened in that break, and I think that may have been the period where he may have had some hip surgery. But I think that's what it really boils down to. It wasn't a matter of, hey, we got this grand plan for Brock Lesnar, 2 years out, you're going to be the one to break the streak. I don't think so. I don't think that was the case at all. I think it was just, it's time for the streak to end, and it just so happens that The Undertaker is wrestling Brock Lesnar this year, and so, Brock, you're going to be the guy. If it was somebody else, it might have been them. I think it might have just been right place, right time. Alex from Vancouver, after seeing the Click reunited at the Hall of Fame ceremony this year, I was wondering what you think would happen if an incident like that occurred today. Considering we are entering the reality era and kayfabe is less relevant than ever, do you think if we saw Daniel Bryan, John Cena, Batista, and Randy Orton embrace in the ring after a match, there would be severe consequences? Just asking this question makes me realize how few true heels there are today, but that is a whole other issue. I'm happy you brought that up, because I want to tie this into something that happened this week with Jim Ross. But before that, do I think that they would face severe consequences the way that those guys did? Probably not. Unless it happened on TV. That would be a different story. But if it was at a house show or something, I mean, look, you probably have a lot of old school guys, right, that work for the company behind the scenes who would not be very happy. That was the case in 96 when they did it. Although there were also stories that some of the wrestlers were bothered by that. Bret Hart and, the British Bulldog kind of not snitched. I mean, everybody knew what happened, but they complained loudly about it, and they're killing kayfabe and all this other stuff. I think, all these years later, I think it's so much of a non-issue. If it's a house show, if it's something that's not done on camera where it would jeopardize storylines and stuff, I don't really see what the big deal is. And of course, of those four, I'm sure John Cena certainly would not get in any sort of trouble. I'm trying to figure out, of that group, if they did get in trouble, who the Triple H would be. Triple H was the new guy back then, and Diesel and Razor were leaving. Shawn was the champion, and he was pretty much untouchable anyway, so it all fell on Hunter. So who would be the Hunter of this group? I guess it would be Bryan, ironically enough. Daniel Bryan probably would be the Triple H of that group if they did get in trouble. But I want to go back. I mentioned Jim Ross. Jim Ross went on something of a Twitter tirade this week about the lack of heels in wrestling, and specifically the lack of heels in WWE. And he posted a whole series of tweets, and I marked them down. I want to just read them. It's like 5 or 6 tweets. He said, "What traits must a top TV wrestling villain possess to motivate ticket buyers to invest in seeing the villain get their ass whipped? Who gets it? If pro wrestling villains rarely cheat, have abundant redeeming social qualities, they're not villains. Stop BSing yourself. Pro wrestling villains must have rules to break. What moves are illegal? Fewer and fewer. That fine gray line between good and evil is a joke." He then started responding to people who were tweeting him. Somebody mentioned Cesaro, and JR said, "What does Cesaro do to cheat or gain an unfair advantage? Nothing of consequence. Same for Lesnar." And I'll get back to that in a second. He said, "I'd estimate that half of today's TV wrestling heels are not equipped with guts and toughness to be great villains. Most would rather be cool." Somebody said, "It's the reality era. It's Shades of Grey." He said, "Shades of Grey sounds all good, but where has that worked? And how do you feel about tweeners?" He says, "Generally, they don't draw a dime. TV wrestling villains must lie, selectively be a coward, be a bully when they can, gain an unfair advantage, bitch and moan, and disrespect the fans." So something must have set him off. I don't know what set him off on this tirade. But he mentioned Brock Lesnar, and I actually disagree on that. And I agree with most of what he's saying here. If you really look at the number of real, true dick heels in wrestling, there aren't really that many of them. I think, you know, in TNA, I hated Aces and Eights. I just thought the whole thing was a giant waste of time. It was a failure. But when Bully Ray was at his most epic heel, his most epic heel self in TNA, there was none better than Bully Ray. Bully Ray was like the closest thing to a classic asshole wrestling heel that we had, probably in any of the major promotions. And now he's a babyface, so you know he's doing something a little bit different. So I agree with him in that respect, but on Brock I have to disagree. Brock Lesnar is the same guy who, back in January at the Royal Rumble, went up against a guy that was actually bigger than him. Now, it's not very often that Brock Lesnar will step in the ring against somebody bigger than him. He's bigger than most, but Big Show is going to be bigger than pretty much everybody else, except maybe Kali. But Brock went in there at the Rumble for a match with Big Show, and instead of facing him head-on, what did he do? He grabbed a steel chair, and he beat the piss out of him. He beat the crap out of the Big Show with a steel chair, and then he left. He walked away. Like a true dick. Like a real asshole heel. Even when Brock isn't cheating, okay, maybe Brock doesn't hook the tights or hold the ropes and stuff like that, but when he's not beating up somebody with a chair, which is actually great, I love that because it's such an asshole thing to do. Brock Lesnar is this big, tough guy who can probably go head-to-head with anybody with his two fists, but yet he resorts to using a weapon. Like, I think that's just classic heel tactics right there. But even when he's not doing that, you know, he's got Paul Heyman there as his mouthpiece. Paul Heyman is his advocate. They go together like peanut butter and jelly. Heyman and Lesnar are the best duo, the best like manager wrestler combo, I think, in the history of wrestling. They are so awesome together. And Brock can go in there and beat the crap out of people. He doesn't care about the fans. He doesn't play to the crowd. And that's probably a shoot. He doesn't care. He goes in, he wants to make as much money as he can. I don't really think he has any sort of allegiance to wrestling. Didn't then, doesn't now. But we're happy to have him because he's so good at what he does. You know, he's a special kind of performer. So I love Brock Lesnar. I mean, I think he's great. And I think he's a great heel. Even if he's not raking the eyes and throwing powder in people's faces, I think there's a little bit of an old school, a little too old school maybe. Not every single heel has to rake the eyes and you know, deliver a low blow. So on Brock, I disagree wholeheartedly. I think he's a great heel, and I think he's a great example, I think, of what other people should probably follow if they wanted to be a similar type of heel. But he is right in a lot of other respects, and I'll throw Bad News Barrett out there as an example. Bad News Barrett is not supposed to be a babyface, okay? That's not the way that he's booked. And I know Vince, you know, now the new edict is that there are no babyfaces and there are no heels in WWE, and that's all fine and good, but that's not how they book. They still book along the lines of, okay, we want you to cheer for this guy, we want you to boo this guy. And Bad News Barrett goes out there every week, and he stands on his podium with his gavel, and he insults the fans, and he calls everybody fat. Okay, that's not a babyface, that's a heel. But when Barrett comes out, you know, Barrett came out on that post-WrestleMania Raw, so maybe this is a bad example because that's a smarky kind of crowd. Did he really do anything illegal? Did he really do anything to get people to want to boo him? It was a pretty straight match, I think, that he had with Rey Mysterio, and, you know, he finished him off with the bullhammer elbow, and he was playing to the crowd like a babyface. And it was great. Like, I was in the arena, and people were going crazy for him, and I actually felt really good for the guy because I couldn't even remember the last time he wrestled a match, so it was nice to see the people actually reacting to Wade Barrett with this gimmick. But you can say that Wade Barrett was an absolutely terrible heel. He was not doing his job. His job should not have been to go out there and do the whole thing where he goes, you know, boom, and he puts his hands in the air. I think at one point he was actually actively trying to get the crowd to start a chant. Maybe it was the English fans, the British fans that he was playing to. That may have been it. But he's playing to the crowd. He's like looking for that kind of babyface reaction, but that's not who he's supposed to be. So I agree with JR in that respect. You know, you got guys on the main roster. I don't want to say they don't know how to be a heel. I mean, it's not my place to say that, but I'm watching these guys, and it's true. You know, they're not really doing anything to get that kind of reaction. Like, go back even a few years. Who were some of the best heels in WWE in the last decade? Okay, I mentioned Brock. I think Brock would have to be up there. The two names, when I said that, that really popped into my head, number one is Edge, and number two is Chris Jericho, who's gone back and forth a lot. But Edge, I thought Edge was a great heel. And he would even do interviews, and he would say, my goal as a heel is to not be a cool heel, to not be like, you know, the NWO back in the day. His goal was to have absolutely no redeemable qualities to his character whatsoever. So that way, nobody would have a reason to cheer for him. And he was awesome. Chris Jericho, when he came back in like 08 and he was wearing the suit and tie, he would talk really low, which is like an old Jake Roberts thing to get the crowd to pay more attention to what you're saying. You know, Jericho went to management. They wanted to make him a t-shirt. He said, no, I don't want any merchandise. People are not supposed to like me. Why would they buy my t-shirt? So I'm sure he lost out on some money by doing that. But that's because he wanted to be a tried and true heel. And when you really look at, we'll take WWE as an example, over the last 10 years, you can't find a lot of guys like that. You can find maybe a handful, but not a lot. And I think that's probably what JR was getting at. And again, I don't know what set him off on this. I don't know if he's reacting to a certain person he saw on TV or if this is just a general thing. Somebody asked him a question. But he makes a lot of very valid points. I disagree on Brock, but on a lot of these other guys, and I use Bad News Barrett as one example. You know, the Wyatt family goes out there, they get cheered a lot, but, you know, I can't really blame Bray Wyatt. I mean, they're not doing anything wrong. Maybe they could be doing more to cheat and to do some really heinous kind of stuff, but it's not like they're going out there trying to play to the crowd. Maybe he is by trying to get them to do the whole, you know, he's got the whole world in his hands kind of stuff, but there's a lot to be said for the lack of real, true heels. Like, guys that you absolutely hate. Not like The Miz, like, get off my TV kind of stuff. A guy that you would actually want to pay money or tune into the, you know, main event segment on Raw because I can't wait to see this guy get his ass kicked. You don't really have a lot of that. You know, Randy Orton, he's a pretty good heel. But Batista? What about Batista? I think Batista now is great in this role. He was completely miscast when he came back as a babyface. Once it was obvious that people hated him or they resented him, you know, for taking a spot away from Bryan or whatever, it was the only move to make. And I think heel Batista, who comes out and actually mocks the fans, is so great. It's so great. And that's part of what makes a good heel. The people already hate me, so let me go out there and give them a reason to hate me. I remember the WrestleMania press conference in New York. He comes up to the podium and he... You know, he's mocking the fans and saying, oh, people like to make fun of me for my skinny jeans. And he just gets on the mic and he says, I have one pair of skinny jeans, and I'm going to wear those skinny jeans every single week just to piss you people off. And I laughed. I thought that was so awesome. So Batista, I think, as a heel right now is great. But, you know, you can count on one hand how many great heels you really have. Jondrix from Montreal, do you see Roman Reigns turning on the Shield and joining Evolution as its fourth member? I've gotten a lot of emails from you guys asking me the exact same question. Do you think Reigns, do you think somebody's going to turn and join Evolution? I don't think so, but if anybody was going to turn, I figure it would be Rollins or Ambrose, not Reigns. I think Reigns' big singles future coming up is as a babyface, and plus Batista's already kind of the heavy. He's the muscle of the group. You don't really need two guys like that. If it was going to be anybody, I think it would be Rollins or Ambrose, but I don't think that's going to happen. Our good friend Wiza sent this in. My question is about Eric Young. With TNA's plethora of WWE ripoff angles, WWE is, of course, guilty of this too. Do you think the Eric Young / Daniel Bryan angle is a bit off? As a TNA original, I have zero problem with him getting the title at some point, but currently he's just a pawn in TNA's business, and it doesn't feel deserved. If you were in Eric's place, how would you feel if they slapped the title on you simply because you look like someone else, having a storyline done correctly and not because of the work you put into the company over the years? I don't know Eric Young. I saw some of the videos on the TNA YouTube channel. They showed when he won the belt and he went backstage. Everyone's hugging him and shaking his hand, and he's almost in tears. I don't really think he looks at it that way. I think he appreciates it. Never in a million years thought he would be the world champion. So I think he's more grateful than anything else. I don't think, I mean, he's not a dumb guy. I'm sure he can probably see what's going on here, but I don't really think he looks at it that way. I think he looks at it as it's finally, you know, vindication for all these years of hard work and people saying you would never do it, and maybe I'm a little smaller than everybody else, or I'm a comedy guy. He probably appreciates it. And if anything, I think he probably feels extra motivated to go out there and prove people wrong. He, you know, he wants to go out there and prove to people that he can be a world champion. So I don't think he would agree with that. But that's just me. I you'd have to ask him. This comes from Albert. It's reported that 600,000 people have the network and 400,000 order the pay-per-view. My question is not how many ordered the pay-per-view, but how about how many of those 600,000 subscribers actually watched the pay-per-view? I say that because WWE did not release viewer numbers for WrestleMania. They released subscription numbers. Out of those network subscribers, how will we find out how many people who have the network actually watch the product? Answer is very simple. You won't, because WWE won't tell you. I'm not even sure if they know how many. I would think they do. They probably have that data. I don't think they're obligated, though, to release those numbers. So we're not going to know. It's a simple answer to your question. You would think that out of 667,000 people paying $9.95 a month, or $9.99, whatever it is, most of those people would watch WrestleMania, you know, the biggest show of the year. But, you know, a lot of them probably maybe went over to a friend's house and they watched it on pay-per-view as a group. A lot of people maybe subscribed to the network who were interested in the old school stuff and they don't give a crap. I can't tell you how many people will write into my show in a given month telling me they don't even watch the product anymore. They just listen to my show out of habit, or they listen to my show because they like it and they just want to keep up on wrestling without actually watching the product now because they can't stomach it. I get a lot of emails like that from people, probably way more than I should. So it's not unreasonable to think that you have a decent number of people, and I don't even know that this number is bigger than 100,000. It's probably less than that. Because if people were so into the old school stuff, then Classics on Demand numbers, which were by the end were horrible, would have been a lot higher. And I know Classics on Demand wasn't available everywhere, but it was available in a lot of places. And by the end, I think the number of subscribers was pretty low. But you will have some people who were just interested in the old stuff and they don't really care about the new stuff. But you would think the majority of that 600,000 would have watched WrestleMania, but we just have no way of knowing. Jay from Florida writes in. Jay's been a listener since episode 33, one of our old school listeners. You talk a lot about not liking makeshift tag teams. If you had to pick one, which would be your favorite or the one that you hate the least? That's a good question. If we're talking all time, I got to go with the Mega Powers, man. I grew up on that stuff. Hulk Hogan and the Macho Man. If I had to go more recent, I'm with you. In his email, he mentioned Bobby Roode and Austin Aries in TNA. They were great together. I was very sad when they broke their team up without doing a proper feud with them and Bad Influence, who apparently aren't even in TNA anymore. But yeah, more recently I'd go with Roode and Aries all time. I got to go with the Mega Powers. Rick from Cincinnati, Ohio. Do you think the wrestling fans can turn John Cena heel? Here we go again. If WWE will not, I would love to see the person in the crowd who catches Cena's hat or t-shirt throw it back into the ring on a Raw episode. What do you think it would take to change his stale, boring gimmick? This is another one. I get at least one question every few days asking me if and when I think John Cena will turn heel, or how they would turn John Cena heel. When is WWE going to turn John Cena heel? They have to turn him. No, they don't. And they won't. Unless, and I guess this would be my answer to anybody who ever emails me asking this. You want to know how to get WWE to consider turning John Cena heel? It's very simple. Stop buying his merchandise. Stop buying his t-shirts. Stop buying his hats. Stop buying his wristbands. And stop watching his segments on TV. When a John Cena promo comes on or a match, change the channel. That's it. Then and only then do I think they would even consider turning the guy heel. If all of a sudden his merchandise isn't selling so well, and his segments aren't the highest rated, then all of a sudden, you know, the gears start going in Vince's head. Well, maybe it's time for a change, you know? And even then, I think the chances are slim. You know, he's a great ambassador for them. The Make-A-Wish stuff, the Susan G. Komen stuff, he's front and center every year on TV talking about it. On the Today Show, all that kind of stuff. As long as they're a PG company doing Scooby-Doo movies, it's not going to happen anyway. But if he suddenly stopped bringing in so much money for them, maybe there's a chance. But really, I would just move on. Can we all just move on from this idea that this is actually going to happen, please? It's not going to happen. Joe from Little Rock, Arkansas. Jim Ross on his blog mentioned if he could book Sting in WWE, it would be a retirement match at WrestleMania 31 against a suitable villain. And even though people would lobby for Undertaker, it would be better for a younger talent, someone who would need the rub. Who would you want to see Sting wrestle in a retirement match at WrestleMania next year, if that was the case? Well, I don't think he would need the rub, but I would love to see Bray Wyatt in that spot. I think a Bray Wyatt-Sting match would be great, with Bray Wyatt going over. Because Sting doesn't have to win his last match. That would be the guy. I would go with Wyatt. And last here, Josh from Steventown, New York. What was your favorite wrestling tape or DVD? For me, it was Tombstone History of the Undertaker. What was yours? My first wrestling tape, I remember this. My first wrestling tape was a Coliseum home video. It had a blue cover with Hulk Hogan on it, wearing, it was like a tiny belt. It wasn't the Hogan 86 belt. It was whichever one came before that. But the title of the video was The Hulkster, Hulk Hogan. What an original name. And it had his title win over the Iron Sheik. It had highlights of that. It had a rematch with him and Sheik. It might have been their first match since the title win, where I remember Hogan bled. He was wearing like laser blue tights. He wasn't in the red and yellow full-time at that point. Had a match with Hogan and Brutus Beefcake, long before he was the barber. And it had a cage match. And this was back when they were still using the mesh, the fence, chain link cage, with him and Don Morocco. That was my very first video. After that, it was the first WrestleMania. In fact, I have the first four WrestleManias on Coliseum home video somewhere. The fourth one is a double tape that when you open it up, Hulk Hogan's head pops up. It's got a Hulk Hogan pop-up. That was the novelty of it, when you would open up this double tape, because it was so damn long. It was like a four-hour show. They had the whole tournament that night. I mean, all the pay-per-views, all the WrestleManias now are 4 hours. But that was a big deal back then. That was much longer than your usual WrestleMania. So those are my earliest videos, but the Hulkster one is the very first one that I remember. And I'm pretty sure I still have that somewhere. If I do, maybe I'll dig it out and tweet a picture of it or something. History has been made here! This week in wrestling history, it was 18 years ago this week on April 15, 1996... Brian Pillman suffered severe injuries as a result of wrapping his Hummer around a tree and flipping the car. He ended up in a coma for a week, shattered his ankle, requiring it to be fused together in a fixed position. If I remember, I don't think it healed properly after the first surgery, and then they took him off TV in that angle where Austin Pillmanized his ankle on Superstars because he needed it operated on again. And I think they had to re-break the ankle, which doesn't sound like any fun at all. And he really was never the same after that. When he came back, I think the summer of the following year. I remember when he came out of the crowd and attacked Austin and joined the Hart Foundation. So he did wrestle for a few months before he died, but he was never the same. 14 years ago this week, on April 17, 2000, one of the most famous angles in Raw history took place. One of my favorites. Chris Jericho's Phantom title win over Triple H in State College, Pennsylvania. Raw absolutely slaughtered Nitro that night. 6.7 to 2.5 in the ratings. That's how far away WWE had gotten with that race, or that war. Can you even call it a war at that point when it's that one-sided? The angle was very simple. Jericho had been making comments about Triple H and Stephanie. There was something there. The show opened, and they were going to have a match, and Jericho used his mouth, as only he could, to coax Triple H into putting his title on the line. This was 6 days before Backlash. Triple H was going to defend the title against The Rock, and he got him to make it a championship match, and Jericho had invested in an insurance policy for the match, which turned out to be Bradshaw and Farouk, the APA, to make sure there were no shenanigans. And so they had a match to open the show. It was actually a really good match, and it built to a ref bump. And so with the referee down, it might have been Mike Chioda, out comes Earl Hebner. Now, Earl Hebner had been part of the McMahon-Helmsley storyline. I think he may have been suspended or something happened, and it was kind of surprising for Triple H to see that Earl Hebner had come out to officiate his match. And I think Triple H shoved him. Earl shoved him back. No, what happened is Earl shoved him, and then Triple H shoved Earl down to the mat. And when Triple H turned around, he turned into a spinning heel kick from Jericho. Jericho did a lion salt, went for the pin. Earl crawled over, fast counted, new champion. Place went nuts. It was so awesome. It was great. And Jericho quickly grabbed the title. He ran up the ramp. Triple H went to go after him, but the APA held him back. He was beside himself. He couldn't believe it. Lillian announced Jericho as the champion. It was great. It was awesome. And they went to commercial. Came back from commercial. Triple H was in the back with Shane. He grabbed Earl, dragged him back to the ring, forced him to admit that he had fast counted him. They even showed a replay of it. Mike Chioda looked up. He said, you know, you fast counted him, Earl. You fast counted Triple H. You screwed him. And Earl said, I did screw you. He basically admitted it. And Triple H said, what you're going to do is you're going to reverse that decision and go backstage and get my belt. And Earl said, I'll do it on one condition. You got to promise that you and your wife, all of you, promise never to put your hands on me again as long as I'm a WWE official. And that was the key. And Triple H said, let me get this straight. As long as you're a WWE official, we can't put our hands on you. He says, you know what? You got a deal. And Jericho wasn't going to wait for Hebner to come back. He came out on stage and made a joke about Stephanie being a whore and sleeping with all the boys. And he gave up the belt, and Earl put it around Triple H's waist. And of course, a great heel, which Triple H was back then, we were just talking about heels a few minutes ago, said, by the way, Earl, you're fired. So therefore, Earl was no longer a WWE official. That was the cue to kick him in the gut. He gave him a pedigree. Jim Ross was absolutely disgusted by this on commentary. I think he said it was like the worst thing he had ever seen in his life or something like that. And I remember as a fan watching that and just being so deflated, you know, like, ah, come on. It was like it never happened. But looking back, I mean, it was a fabulous angle. It was great. And Triple H lost the belt to The Rock anyway 6 days later, but definitely one of the best angles in Raw history. 7 years ago this week, on April 16, 2007, Santino Marella made his debut on Raw, special edition from Milan, Italy. This was the Milan Miracle. He beat Umaga for the Intercontinental title. He was just a fan in the crowd, and they were looking for competition for Umaga. He volunteered. They thought it was like the lamb going to slaughter. Bobby Lashley ended up interfering and providing the assist. Santino won. So his first night in, he becomes champion, just like Paige did recently. And hopefully things will work out for Paige, one would hope, a lot better than they did for Santino as far as being... Well, you know what? I shouldn't even say that. Santino is still employed. After all these years later, he actually has a role for himself in WWE. So, you know, the fact that he's not like a top guy really doesn't matter. You know, he's got a good place in the company. I would think Paige would be happy with that, you know, if 6-7 years from now she's still doing well for herself in some role, in some form or fashion on that roster. Gail Kim, not so much. Gail Kim won the women's title her first night in, and things didn't work out as well for her. Also, 7 years ago this week, on April 19, 2007, Austin Starr was sent home by TNA Wrestling after management was said to be unhappy with his attitude. He would not return to the company until 2011 under the name Austin Aries. And finally, 6 years ago this week, on April 15, 2008, WWE banned all photographers from shooting at ringside, as they had been doing for decades. This move coincided with their transition to HD. And I guess they felt having them at ringside would be a distraction. So now they have a pit area set up near the hard camera where the photographers are positioned for all the television events. George Napolitano and I talked about this during my interview with him on Sound Off 182. If you want to go back in the archives, it's also up in full on our YouTube channel. I don't know. I always thought having the photographers physically at ringside made it feel like a bigger deal. I mean, maybe it's just me. I remember asking George that question in our interview, and I was kind of surprised by his answer. I think I had asked him which way he liked it better, or did he mind? And he actually loves being in the pit area, because now he doesn't have to roam around and kind of fight other photographers for that good shot, you know, for that good position. So he, you know, plus I think he gets to sit down. He doesn't have to stand up. I didn't really look at it like that. So he didn't seem to mind the move as much. And I think at house shows and non-TV events, the photographers are still allowed to be at ringside. It's just for TV events. So that was 6 years ago this week. And that's this week in wrestling history. If you have questions for the mailbag, please keep sending them in to me. I am overflowing with emails. I can't respond back to everybody, but please do know that when you send me something, I do read it. And we'll try to get it on the show if I can. TheSolemonster@gmail.com is the place to go for that. You can follow me on Twitter, @Solemonster. And you can also friend me on Facebook or join our Facebook group, which is now well over 2,100 members and counting. There's a lot of activity going on there, a lot of good people, a lot of good wrestling discussions. So it's a closed group. You have to apply for membership. I will approve you, and you can join in the fun there. And subscribe to our YouTube channel as well. I hope to get a new video up soon. I know it's been a few weeks, but if you search for Solemonster Sounds Off on YouTube, you'll see some of our videos come up. Click on the channel, subscribe. That way, when a new video goes up, you will be notified as such. Now, I said that I would have an update at the end of the show for you on my status with the Layfield Report, which sounds kind of ominous. And it is, in that it appears I am no longer writing for the Layfield Report. And I say it appears because I can't seem to get a straight answer out of anybody. I can't seem to get a straight answer out of the person mainly who is responsible for managing the blog postings on Layfield Report, and I'll get to him in a second. So, you know, imagine my surprise, put a column together. Actually, I did a column on the Ultimate Warrior documentary, which I went in depth on earlier in the podcast. I thought it was fantastic. And notice that, you know, when I logged in, I was not able to post a new column. So I was able to log in, but did not see the mechanism that I would normally use to post a new column. Thought it was very odd. Sent an email to this person, letting him know what was going on, asking for any help. Sat idly by. Never got an answer. Let a whole day go by. Sent another email on Saturday, which would have been yesterday morning, saying, you know, hey, I'm having the same issues. I don't know if it's a glitch or what the deal is here. I have this column. It's, you know, somewhat time sensitive. If you could look into this and let me know what's going on, I would love to know, you know, what's up. Never got a response. In the midst of all of this, I happened to check. I don't even know what possessed me to check this, because I had already been following him, but hadn't noticed until just the other day when I went to JBL's Twitter page and attempted to refollow, because I saw I'm not following him. I said, that's kind of odd. I'm pretty sure I was following the guy. And when I went to attempt to re-add him, I was informed that I had, in fact, been blocked. Yes, I had been blocked on Twitter by JBL. Now, when this happened, I have no earthly idea. I have no idea when this happened. I have no idea why I would have been blocked. The only thing, I've racked my brain, the only thing I could think of, because one thing, if you follow JBL on Twitter, you know that he's very quick to block just loads of people at once. I mean, he goes on these blocking rampages. Because there's a lot of people who tweet a lot of stupid stuff, and even stuff that maybe isn't so stupid, but if it bothers him, he'll block you. It's almost comical. The only thing I could think of is that somebody had tweeted something to him that he didn't like and maybe copied me on the tweet, and in a blocking rampage, I kind of got swept up in that, you know, like caught in the crossfire kind of thing. But I have no idea. I just saw that, and I couldn't help but laugh. I almost wear it as a badge of honor. So I don't know, you know, how that plays into this at all. I really just don't know anything. So again, I had emailed this person on Friday when I realized I couldn't post a column, got no response, when normally I would get a response pretty quickly. This person's been pretty responsive in the past. And I mean, there's no big secret here. I mean, the person who's in charge of managing the blogs on that website and who is involved in that website is Arda Ocal. Some of you may know that name, some of you may not. You can look him up. He's the one who has been the point person now for some time. And sent that second email yesterday morning, got no response. As far as I know, clearly he's around and he's tweeting and all that kind of stuff. And between the blocking and between this, I can pretty much see the writing on the wall. But to me, What irritates me mostly, it's not even the JBL stuff. I don't, you know, doesn't bother me really at all. Like, I'm, you know, I'm still a JBL fan. Look, I've enjoyed writing for the website. I've written for the website now for about 15 months. And it's been a fun 15 months. You know, I've contributed a whole bunch of columns that have been very well received. You guys have given me some great feedback. I think I've picked up some new listeners as a result. And even the non-wrestling stuff that I did, you know, not this past season, but the season before, I was the Walking Dead person on the website. I would do the reviews and recaps of the episodes of Walking Dead every single week. And I enjoyed that. And I opted not to do it for the most recent season. So even the non-wrestling contributions I made to that website, I enjoyed. And my work is still up, at least for now. Maybe it won't be after this, but my work is still up there if you want to go back and read some of those old articles. What bothers me the most is just the lack of communication. To me, it just comes off as really low rent. And to be perfectly honest with you, you know, it comes off to me as a lack of courage. That's really the best way that I can describe it. There's no reason to not send an email back and just let me know what's going on, especially when I'm legitimately none the wiser here. I legitimately thought it was a glitch. And, you know, you put two and two together at this point and you figure, okay, it's probably not a glitch. But to get no email response, like I said, that's to me is very low rent and just shows a lack of courage. That's very surprising and very disappointing because I didn't look at that person that way before. But now I do. So that's the story. That's the Layfield Report update. It's unfortunate, but we move on from here. I'm hopeful to get that article that I mentioned on the Warrior documentary up on Yahoo. I haven't gotten a Yahoo column up in a while. The thing with Yahoo is that it's a little frustrating. It takes time. So if you do something timely, I mean, it could be up to 10 days to 2 weeks before your article gets approved and posted. And if you catch a lucky break, maybe it takes only 3 or 4 days. So I actually did a column about the Warrior documentary. I'm hoping that it will get up at some point this week on Yahoo. And if it does, I'll, you know, tweet out a link. Hopefully you guys can pass that along and show that some love. So I just wanted to let you guys know what was going on because I'm sure at some point there would be questions. Hey, what happened? Or when's your new column going to be up? And I just, instead of dealing with all that down the road, I figure let's just get it all out in the open. I really don't know the full story myself. I still hope to find out. But the lack of communication and just, you know, being ignored by this individual is very disappointing. And like I said, it just shows a lack of courage and a lack of class. So, on that happy note, that's episode 324 of The Sound Off. Thank you, as always, for downloading the podcast, supporting me in my various endeavors, and supporting this show. You can make a PayPal donation. You can, again, when articles go up, wherever they may be, forward them, share them, retweet them, whatever. I do appreciate all of your help. And we'll be back with a new episode next weekend, episode 325, which might be, is that the last weekend before Extreme Rules? We might have one more show after that. We could do predictions. So that's coming up in the near future. Until then, be well, stay safe. Thank you again. And we will see you right back here next week. Take care, guys.
You've been listening to the Sala Monster Sounds Off, giving you the good.
I beat the authority, and right now I stand here as the new WWE World Heavyweight Champion!
The bad.
Brock Lesnar into the cover, hooks the leg, the streak is over.
And the ugly.
Well, we are here with the new married couple.
Now we're tag team partners for life.
Sean and Marty said the same thing once upon a time.
Oh, I knew he was going to do that.
What a despicable act that was.
No. Oh, my God.
Well, mostly the good.
Sala Monster Sounds Off.
Since 2007 on thesalamonster.com, Stitcher Radio, and iTunes.
Sala Monster Sound Off.